Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you today. Members of Parliament, members of HARO, my interpreters, ladies and gentlemen. Is there anyone who doesn't fall into one of those categories? I think I have everyone covered. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, members of Parliament, for arranging this weather. I appreciate how much power you have over these things. This is beautiful, a beautiful setting. I'm glad this is the my second time here, and I'm delighted to be invited to address a very significant question, a significant question not only here in Sweden, all over Europe, all over North America, in Japan, all over civilized countries. Actually, is have this concern. Is that by many indications, our schooling is running into trouble. It is not as efficient, not as effective. The literacy rates are decreasing among adolescents. So something is happening. Something is happening that is rather global, widespread, in different areas a bit more than others. Teaching is getting harder. Teaching is actually getting harder, which is very ironic, given the fact that we have never been, teachers have never been better trained. We have never had better technology. Our pedagogy has never been more well-honed, and our curriculum never better informed. And yet, despite all of these advances, something is happening. And I want to suggest that it's not in the teaching. I want to suggest that it's not in the schooling. We now have some of the best systems in the world. And I would suspect that you do here in Sweden. I think we have a tremendous system in Canada. And so I don't think it has to do with this. I think it has more to do with this question. And so I'm delighted to answer this question. Where have all the children with a hunger to learn gone? There is something changing about the characteristics of our students. And that is by far the greatest factor in determining success in the education system. So while we're trying to figure out how to teach harder, how to teach better, what curriculum we should use, and how to harness the technology of the contemporary age, something is slipping away on us. And that is exactly what I want to address. Now, the particular approach that I'm using in this is people are very well aware in science that that research is how we gather information, but that's not how we interpret information. Research is how we gather, and then another way is in which we interpret is which we try through synthesis and distillation to create a model that accounts for all the evidence. This is a long process. It is a process that takes years of putting the pieces together. It's like a huge puzzle. And you try to put the pieces together until a picture emerges, a model that can explain the evidence in the largest possible way. My job is as a theorist, which is always the balance to the data gathering, the research. My role is to create a model that makes sense of the data when all the data is gathered. And I'm going to try and present that model to you today, not in a comprehensive way. I'm going to present it to you through this particular question as a way of answering this question and through a series of other questions. And so that is the approach I take. I hope it makes sense. Again, the dominant question is, where have all the children with a hunger to learn gone? This isn't the best English, but apparently it works very well in Swedish. And so we will stay with this. When I was posed this question, I thought, well, no, let me change it a bit. But I think this has got it. And I love the concept of hunger, because at the end, I think this will make a very good sense. And hunger to learn is a very good way of putting it. And so I will start, though, with a different question. a different question that when I first of all started working with troubled adolescents was a question I was teaching at the University of British Columbia, and at the same time trying to understand, as I consulted for prison schools, why these children of average intelligence, who had the most dedicated teachers you could imagine, who had passion for their job, why it is that these children were not learning. And so this began a question of trying to gather all the research. And the question is, what are the characteristics of a good learner? What are the attributes of a good learner? Now, this is a tremendous exercise in itself, but I will. This is a summary of this material, and so I will give you the conclusions of this, by and large, what all the literature points to. And there are three characteristics that stand out, three attributes that stand out. The first is very obvious. Children who are interested and curious about the world they are not familiar with, who are asking questions about that world, and who have a sense of agency in the learning process. Now, agency is difficult to interpret in English as well as Swedish. And so what it actually means in Latin is that a child is at the steering wheel, or literally at the chariot seat, at the reins. That is, that they see themselves as having an involvement in their learning. They see themselves as making choices in the learning. They are in the driver's seat, and this has a tremendous effect on their ability to learn. So this is one of the attributes. And unfortunately, we used to think that every single child was interested and curious. We used to think naively that if we could only find the right pedagogy, only find the right curriculum, only find the right learning style, only find their right, the right teaching style to match to it, that then we would have success. Unfortunately, this is not true. There are many children who show no evidence of curiosity and interest whatsoever. And one of the unfortunate, alarming statistics is that there's many more children that are curious and interested at the beginning of in their early grades than there are in their last grades. And so something is wrong. Something is wrong in our society. Something is not right that we should have more children interested and curious in kindergarten and grade one than we have in the finishing grades of school. And we'll look at what that problem is. But here is just to understand that not all children are interested and curious, and their numbers seem to be decreasing rather than increasing. The number of children, for instance, one of the opposites of this is the attribute of boredom, of feeling bored. And we well know statistically that boredom is escalating in our society and among children. And so this is a direct opposite to interest and curiosity. So something is going on. Something is making it much more difficult. A second attribute is the ability to learn from mistakes, from trial and error, and from consequences. It is estimated that 80% of all learning in school is through trial and error. Again, we made a mistake in psychology in the 60s and 70s. We made a mistake, and we thought that every child could learn from mistakes, from trial and error, and from failure. And we have found, to our dismay, in neuroscience, that there are many children who cannot learn from their mistakes, who do not learn from consequences, who make the same mistake over and over again. And these children are not benefiting from a system that is based on trial and error. Again, we assume that if we only teach right, if we only teach harder, if we find the right curriculum, if we have the best schools in the world, but the best schools in the world are not touching these students, and it is making it more difficult, and their numbers seem to be increasing. The number of children who show no evidence of being able to learn from their mistakes are escalating, and the diagnosis of these children is increasing. So again, we have a problem. There's a third There's a third attribute, and this attribute is the ability to think twice, to process conflicting ideas, to benefit from a dialectic, from confrontation. The idea that you have to take both this into consideration and that into consideration to solve a social problem, a science problem, a literature problem in terms of a theme for a literature. You have to be able to feel what is called in developmental psychology cognitive dissonance. You have to be able to feel what is called in neuroscience, you have to feel emotional discord, inner conflict. And we find that a remarkable number of students and even adults in our society show no inner conflict, no ability to benefit from confrontation. They think in black and white. They think in either or terms. They are impulsive. They do not benefit. They are not able to learn. And much of our learning is through the dialectic, through confrontation to the element not considered. Again, we thought this was universal. We thought that all children were able to do so. Piaget demonstrated to us that young children are incapable of this. None of them say, on the other hand. None of them say, part of me thinks this way and part of me thinks that way. And you know adults who don't say that. And so this requires a development. It requires a development. And this is not automatic. And now we know a much even more important thing is many people don't experience having opposite feelings, conflicting feelings. Part of me is excited about this. That is, I see the treasure. Part of me is apprehensive, afraid of this. I see the dragon. And there's so many children who do not see both the dragon and the treasure at the same time. So the question becomes, if these are the attributes of a good learner, we used to think that every children possessed them, and it was the key to this was to be able to teach in the right way. And so we've designed schools. And here in Sweden, you've designed your schools. We in Canada have designed our schools assuming that all children could benefit from their mistakes, learn from trial and error, were interested and curious, and able to process or capable of process inner conflict. And what is happening is we're getting more and more children who do not possess these attributes. And so the next question we ask is, where do the characteristics of a good learner come from? Where do the characteristics of a good learner come from? What is the source? What is the etiology of these? What are the origins of this? If we put this around the phenomena here, the phenomena of the attributes of a good learner, and we've surrounded that phenomena with these attributes that are characteristic of a good learner, a child who will benefit from his education, from his schooling, the question is, where do they come from? Well, this again is a large subject, and I wish I could have you here in your seats for 2 weeks. I would love nothing better than to have a captive audience and to go through all of this, have you in my courses in university. But I'll summarize here very, very quickly. We start off with curiosity and interest and agency. What is it a result of? And we find that it is part of the process of becoming viable as a separate being. The basic thrust in the development of the organism and the fetus is to become viable as a separate being, to walk on one's own two feet, think for oneself, have one's own meanings, have one's own boundaries. And this viability, movement towards this viability, is part of this. And then the attention is directed to the things that I'm not attached to, I'm not familiar, which is interest and curiosity. And part of this process is to move from where life happens to you in the passenger seat of life to the driver's seat of life, where you are a player in your own life. And this is a wonderful movement. We cannot teach anybody to be this. This is a result of one of the maturing processes called the emergent process or differentiation process or individuation process. It's one of the basic processes by which we mature as individuals. We cannot make children grow up. We cannot cause them to to grow up. You know, although we say to children all the time, grow up, we even say that to our spouses, you know, grow up, act your age. We cannot teach them to be this way. This is no more than we can teach a geranium to grow up or an oak tree to grow up. This is a process of maturation. And this is where that particular attribute comes from. And one of the tragedies of life is the fact that we all grow older. We cannot help that. But we don't all grow up. We don't all become truly mature. And this is one of the signs of true maturation process in a child. And many children are being arrested in their development. They're growing up physically, but they're not growing up emotionally and psychologically. And this is what we require. Now we look at, can a child learn from mistakes, from trial and error, and from consequences? Where does this come from? Why is it that some children are not demonstrating this particular capability? Let me illustrate, first of all, in terms of the emergent process, just this diagram here. The emergent process to diagram the whole desire is viability as a separate being. That is a yearning. This energy comes from inside out. It is movement. The sign of it is vitality. There is a sense of vitality. The opposite is boredom. And when you turn the screens off, you turn the stimulation off, is a child bored or is a child full of emergent energy? We can tell this even at 2 years of age, if there is what we call emergent play in a child, moves from the inside out. More and more children are presenting without this, and it is alarming that children are not moving. There is not this emergent energy in children. It's a venturing forth energy. You even see it in a two-year-old. Do it myself. You know, dividing the world into me and not me, wanting to be the origin of one's own meanings. It's a wonderful energy. Again, the question is where it comes from, but we'll get to this next. But we'll go to the next question is where does this attribute that come from in which a child can learn from mistakes, from trial and error, and from consequences? This turns out to be part of a very important process by which we become changed by coming to terms with that which we cannot change. Humans are the most adaptive, potentially, of all creatures, but it's the potential part that is the issue here. We thought that all humans were adaptive. We find that all humans have the potential of being adaptive, just like the potential of being curious and interested. But it requires a process. And the process that it requires, interesting enough, is that when we come and when we encounter futility, something that cannot work, will not work, we cannot change, we cannot control in life, when we come up against something, against a futility in life, then that futility has to be felt emotionally. It has to sink in. The limbic system, the emotional brain we find, is in charge of this adaptation. And so if we're going to become resilient in the face of adversity, if we are going to be able to handle not getting our way, not winning all the time, be able to cope with having a baby brother and a baby sister, with mom and dad splitting and not being together, with all kinds, with not being best at what I can do. If I have to do that, the futility of being able to get my way has to sink in. The ability of being able to change things that I cannot change has to sink in. And very interesting, an indication of this, of futility sinking in, is remarkable as we study this process of human evolution in the individual. Is how we evolve as individuals, is when the futility sinks in. You know, mommy said no, I can't do this, there is no more. When the futility sinks in, and it really sinks in, then the signals are sent to the lacrimal glands from the amygdala in the limbic system, and the eyes water. And so tears have always been a symbol of human adaptation. When there are big losses and big griefs, then, of course, we cry about the things we cannot change in our life. And the literature is coming in and saying that children must have their tears of futility. That's different than tears cried to onions. And it's different than tears cried to upset and frustration. Tears of futility are very special tears. The tears of futility are when you let go of something, when you sense that I cannot get through this way. It's not going to go that way. And these tears of futility, it's like walking the maze. There's many more things that do not work than will. And life is like this. And the story of human evolution on the individual's style is we come and we counter a wall of futility. And when we come, it's now called in physiology to the still point, when it sinks in and I'm not going to get my way. This is not going to happen. And then it moves a young child to sadness. And then the energy changes to walk through the maze. And after that has happened two or three times, the brain is convinced that I can now survive having a baby brother, making a mistake, not getting my way, being able to do this. And this is the journey of transformation. The ancient Greeks knew this. They called the big futilities of life tragedies. And of course, the symbol of a tragedy is the tear. And they designed plays to confront humans with their futilities because they knew that the key to civilization, the key to learning by mistakes, the key to this was the ability to come to terms with the futilities in life, that we had to have our tears, at least on the inside as adults, about the things we could not change in our life. We have lost this wisdom in our society. Many children are coming to us and they have lost their tears so much that in very early years, the 10 most common syndromes that children are diagnosed with today are what are called by some experts the tearless syndromes. Children have lost their ability to come to terms with futility, and they're coming into our schools with a compulsive and doing the same things over and over again and unable to adapt to the circumstances and situations. And these are the students who cannot learn from their mistakes, who do not benefit from consequences, from sanctions. And their numbers are increasing by all evidence. Their numbers are increasing. And this is, and so it is true that all children have the potential of adapting, but it is equally true that more and more children are losing this place. All the children I was dealing with as delinquent adolescents had lost this place. They were devoid of curiosity and interest, but they were devoid of the sadness when they came up against the things they could not change in their life. So they were untransformed and nothing changed them. They were stuck doing the same thing over and over again that did not work. Now we go to the third one. A child can process conflicting thoughts and feelings. And again, we find that no child under the age of 5 can do this. No child can do this. This is the characteristic of their life, living in terms of either or. They can only see the dragon or the treasure. They have no capability of conflicting ideas, no capability of emotional discord. So how does this happen? Well, this is the subject of today's neuroscience in being able to find the brain. And they realize that the mixing bowl of the brain, there is a mixing bowl in the brain, the prefrontal cortex, and it doesn't even get wired up for action until 5 years of age. And the good news is that most prefrontal cortexes become capable of functioning at that time, the mixing bowl of the brain, but there has to be emotional support. The child has to be able to feel his feelings. Certain things have to be true for the child to be able to do this. And if he exercises his feelings, if he his mixed feelings, this prefrontal cortex grows. And we are taking pictures of the adolescent brains now, the brain imaging, and finding the adolescents who are impulsive, who cannot do togetherness without loss of separateness, who cannot keep their individuality, hold on to themselves when they're in community, who do not regard the separateness of others, who are impulsive, who never feel inner conflict, that their brains as adolescents, their prefrontal cortex is still the same size as a 4-year-old. It hasn't grown. The good news is it's never too late. The bad news is it takes time. And it takes a supporting environment to do this. And so neuroscience is now showing the prefrontal cortex is the key to all civilized behavior. It is the key to where we have self-control. We can live with each other. We can be good husbands and wives, have togetherness without the loss of separateness, live in community. We used to think this could be taught. And if we could only get children to school, we could teach them to get along. We could teach them to be nice to each other. We could teach them not to be mean to each other. Now we find that this is not the answer at all. This is a process of maturation. Every single human being is capable of becoming considerate, of self-control. It has nothing to do with being taught. It has to do with being grown, that this is a human potentiality. This is entering into our humanness. This is a part of the maturation process. This process is called the integrative process. And as I said, this process is all about mixing signals and everything in the brain. The corpus callosum between the two brains, they separate, and then when the signals are specializations of each, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere is developed, and then the corpus callosum, the bridge grows, and now we can use our both brains at once instead of only be right-brained or left-brained. Everything is based this way, and same with having conflicting ideas. Part of me thinks this way, part of me thinks that way, but now I can feel both of them at the same time, and this is the dissonance, which is the motor of development, and especially with mixed feelings. Part of me wants to belong, but part of me wants to be my own person, and now I live with the dissonance, and part of me would like to bite his head off, but part of me doesn't want to get into trouble, and I live with these mixed feelings. And part of me is very frustrated with mommy, and I want to hit her. But part of me loves her, and I don't want to hurt her. And this is the key to civilization. This is exactly the job of the prefrontal cortex. You cannot teach the prefrontal cortex how to act. It has to be grown, and this is the key. And this is the missing aspect. So all of these attributes are a result of the maturing processes. There are three maturing processes. These are basic processes that bring us to be fully human and which bring us to be able to benefit from the school system. Now, the unfortunate thing is we cannot teach a child to be like this. The fortunate thing is we can teach a child who is like this wonderfully. These children benefit from the school system. But if you try to reinforce curiosity, all the research shows it makes it go away. You cannot teach a child how to be a good learner, but you can teach a good learner many, many things. And this is not in our genetics. It has nothing to do. Every single child has a capability of being curious and interested, processing conflicting thoughts and feelings, and learning from mistakes. Every single child. But then the question becomes, where does this come from? Always in maturation, I'm a developmentalist. And the main question for any developmentalist is, what are the conditions that are conducive to human beings realizing their potential? And because childhood is the place where most of this should happen, the question is around child. What are the conditions? But before we go to this, let me reiterate here what the issue is. These are all a result of the maturation process. These attributes come from growth, not from teaching. They come from maturation. And so the answer, part of the answer to the question we have posed, is the characteristics of the good learner are the fruit of the maturing processes, not genetics nor learning. No matter how good our schools would be, we could have perfect schools and we could flunk. We could have perfect schools. So far, we're bragging. You in Sweden brag tremendously as we do in Canada. We've got the best schools in the world. I'm not quarreling with that. Not quarreling. When I speak to teachers all over the world, I'm not quarreling with this. I don't think there's a way that, in a sense, you could improve our curriculum, our pedagogy, or our technology. The problem is the characteristics of the good learner are grown, not taught. And this is a problem we have to come to terms with in society. Our system is based, as you know, here in Sweden, as ours is, our school system is based upon the Austrian model. And the Austrian model, which is different than the school systems based on traditional models, like in Provence or in Japan, which were based on traditional models, our system is based upon the Austrian model, which assumes that all children are somewhat emergent. All children are somewhat adaptive. They can learn from their mistakes. All children, by the time they're 5 or 6 years of age, can deal with conflict. This is what the system is based on, and that's why more and more children are falling through the cracks of our system. There is another system, school systems of, through the world, that do not assume a modicum of maturity, but they rather assume immaturity. Those systems actually are beginning to be favored. Because they do not assume this. More and more children are falling through the cracks. We now have in Canada a huge alternate education system for these students, and I sometimes tease teachers that in 10 years we will all be in the alternate education system, and the children who are demonstrating curiosity and interest, ability to learn from mistakes, will be fewer. They will be in the minority rather than in the majority, unless we address the root problem here. So the question then we ask, well, what are the conditions that foster maturation and thus result in a good learner? What are the conditions that foster maturation? That give rise to it, that give birth to it, and thus result in the good learner. And again, this is a huge subject, and one which I will then again try and summarize for you in this way. And I'll try to summarize it this way: what is required, first of all, for a child to emerge as a viable separate being? What is the primary condition required? And we find that one condition is more important than any other. And that condition is that a child is held securely in the context of deep, fulfilling attachments. In other words, there's a prior need that all children have. Children are born with a capacity to be curious, but this is not the preeminent need. The preeminent need is for contact, for closeness, for love, for affection, for belonging, significance. This is the prior need of all human beings. We are creatures of attachment, and this is our hunger. And just like in terms of learning, those of you that teach in immigrant areas of your country know that when there is chaos in a child's life, and they don't even get the benefit of a hot meal before they come to school, is that you cannot expect to teach children who are hungry physically, is that you have to give them food to be able to release their mind. Well, it turns out that attachment hunger is even greater than physical hunger. And what is happening is our children are not coming to school with their attachment needs fulfilled in a context where where they feel and can take for granted the contact and closeness with mom and dad, the love and affection of mom and dad, the belonging and significance with mom and dad. Their attachment needs are not being met, and these children do not show any evidence of curiosity, of interest, of wanting to be their own persons. They show rather evidence of huge attachment hunger, of wanting to keep in contact and stay in touch, a huge attachment hunger, usually with their peers. And this is beginning to be the profile of today's learners, of ones that are far more preoccupied with contact and closeness with each other. They come to school not to learn, but to be with their friends. And then we have to figure out some way of getting the curriculum down them. But they're not coming to school saying in the morning, "Mom and Dad, I'm so excited about going to school today. I am so thrilled that I will get the opportunity to be able to learn about the roots of democracy and where it came from. And, you know, it is such a wonderful opportunity to be able to be part of this." And no, they're coming is Hannah going to be at school today? And they're coming with a hunger for contact and closeness. So it is, a child has to be held securely in deep, fulfilling attachments. And I'll flesh that out somewhat for you. It turns out that to be adaptive, a child has to be held in a different way. The child has to be held by the person who can provide comfort. Now, the only one who can provide comfort to a child, only one who can provide comfort. He is the one that the child is securely and safely attached to. And so that designates the comforter. Most of us are only free to cry in the arms of those that we are attached to, that we feel safe with. Every single one of us needs a place of tears, but that is a place to come to terms with life, but that is a place of attachment and needs to be held in that place until there is nothing left to do but cry. For years, I wondered, what is my role as a therapist? What am I doing as a therapist? And then finally it occurred to me, what am I doing as a therapist when I work with adults who things haven't worked with in life, who all kinds of, there were losses and lacks, is I couldn't heal them. I couldn't make things better for them. I couldn't be a substitute mother or father. I had to hold them in that place, and they had to be in relationship with me enough, attached to me enough, so that I could hold them in that place of futility where they couldn't change their world until there was nothing left to do but have their sadness and disappointment about the things in their life. This is a wonderful place of attachment. This is disappearing in our society, is this place, not only being a place of being held in deep, fulfilling attachments, but being held in this context. Every child needs to come home from school. Every child, and there be a place for them when they're asked, how was your day, to burst into tears, especially the young children, about the things that did not work. He called me, he called me stupid, and she doesn't like me, and to have their sadness about the things that do not work, because research tells us that's the only way we become resilient. We don't become resilient until we can have our sadness about the things that do not work in our life. And so this too is a fruit of what we now call attachment or good relationships. About the integrative process, actually, this turns out to be very rooted in attachments. Not, we must be easily moved to our feelings before our feelings can mix. Today's children are showing as defended against feelings. In fact, they follow a standard of being cool, which is to have no affect. To be cool, to not be stirred up. All emotional health is based upon being easily moved. Easily moved to excitement, easily moved to sadness when things do not work. Moved to care, moved to miss, easily moved to caution when things are unsafe. And this, but I have to feel my feelings. I have to be able to experience those feelings. And so my heart has to be soft, so to speak. And the question is, well, how do hearts stay soft? In the resilience research, all the research points out, and there's many, many studies here, that say the main factor in a child having a soft heart, not defended against vulnerability, but a soft heart, is to be shielded against external wounds by a strong emotional connection with a caring adult. And that isn't even true in adolescence. That's why the adults in a child's life, the parents, need to matter more than the peers, because when they lose the shield against this, the child loses soft heart. And of course, throughout our children today is, I don't care, doesn't matter, whatever. And children are escalating in losing their sense of apprehension. Many children no longer say, I'm scared, I'm nervous. The children of atrocities that are coming into our newspapers, what the journalists notice is they are not moved to tears. They are not moved to alarm. They are not moved to say sorry. There is no tender feelings in them. This is a function of attachment when we lose the context of this. And so the answer to this, very simply, the answer to this, to where these attributes come from, is these are a fruit of the attachment processes. In other words, the answer here is that a deep, fulfilling attachment is required to foster maturation and thus produce a good learner. This is rather ironic, because what it says is, attachment is the womb of maturation. Attachment is the womb of maturation, not experience, not pushing. We don't pull and push a child to grow up, not trying to get them independent, not experience in interacting with each other. We can't teach this maturation process. It is growing just like the fetus develops when the womb of maturation is there. In other words, paradoxically, a good learner is not made at school. A good learner is made at home. School is where we teach the students. Home is where we create the students. And if in our society we are not supporting that place where students are created, we start to lose ground in society because our adolescents no longer become integrated into our system, no longer are showing the true attributes of maturation. Empathy, consideration has taken a nosedive in the last 20 years from research in North America. We are losing the war. According to Robert Bly in Sibling Society, the poet laureate and formerly so of United States, says that the single most important factor that accounts for what is happening in North America is immaturity. We're not growing up. Maturation, this is the context for maturation, is the home. And then we can teach the students who have a modicum of maturity, and then everything goes well. But we need a partnership. We need a partnership. We've lost that partnership. We are not supporting that place where we produce good learners. So what is a deep attachment? What is a deep attachment? What does it look like? How does it develop? I took a year out from my studies on sabbatical 10 years ago to try to address this question. I tried to read everything there was about attachment. I tried to read and put it all the pieces together because there's many theories of attachment, and I tried to find one theory that accounted for all the evidence. And very briefly, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like. And I'll use the analogy of a plant. And like plants, like you see here, all the maturation part of a plant is on top of the soil. It's what we see, it's what we celebrate, in the flowers, in the fruit, in the greenery, in the foliage. Beautiful, we celebrate it. And this comes from, but what's the most important part of the plant is not what you see, but what you don't see. There's at least as much going on underneath the soil, and it is much more important because that is where a plant is attached. That is where a plant is rooted. Now, as a society, we become more conscious of the things, the achievement, the academic achievement. We become more conscious of children being good and the conduct. But it's what we don't see that tells a story. And if we're not wise as a society, we begin to focus on the symptoms. Just like if we lost our wisdom as gardeners, we begin to push for fruit. We begin to push for flowers and forget that it's all about being able to provide the conditions that are conducive. Nature can do this very well on its own, thank you. It doesn't need our help. What we need to do is provide the conditions that are conducive. We need to focus on this plant becoming well-rooted, and we need to nurture those roots. And so the attachments are what are underneath the soil. And it turns out when all the pieces are put together, it turns out that that the capacity for relationship develops in about six phases, and these phases unfold, and they're almost meant to unfold, it seems, like one a year for the first 6 years of life. But it's meant to unfold this way. If everything goes well, a child will fall into attachment with his parents, with his grandparents, with the relatives, with those that are involved with the child. He will fall into attachment with them in a wonderful, beautiful way over the first 6 years, and it looks something like this. In the first year of life, a child is absolutely preoccupied with being with, being in sight, in smell, being in sound, being in touch. This is a preoccupation of the child to be with. This is such a strong preoccupation, even as adults, of this preoccupation, that when we're very primitively attached, and that is all there is to us, and we are very primitively attached, the society has now invented, finally, a technology of attachment, a technology of staying in touch. It was inevitable inevitable that we would get there as a society to invent this technology, because this is the most important thing. There's nothing that could be more important to us than being with and being in touch. So the telephone changed our civilization, and that is nothing compared to what we have now. The cell phone, messaging, social networking, all the technology of staying in touch. And our children are becoming addicted to it because they are creatures of attachment. This is the most significant technology ever. But it was only meant to be the beginning. Only meant to be the beginning. By the second year of life, a child is moved to become like those to whom he's attached. And we have long studied, and as those of you that are educators, have studied the origin of language. How does a child come to learn to talk, to speak? Well, it's part, now we understand, of attachment. Very simply, we talk like those to whom we are attached. And it's part of our process of wanting to imitate, wanting to emulate. And so the secret of literacy is this attachment. Now, you probably know as educators that we're losing the war all over the world of in literacy, is that adolescents are becoming less articulate, not more articulate, and over the decades, they are losing words, not adding words. This despite the billions of dollars we're spending on literacy all over the world. But the answer is very simple, is adolescents are more likely to be attached to each other now than to their teachers and their parents and grandparents. And so, who do they talk like? Each other. How many words do you need to speak to each other? Apparently not very many. And so we find that the vocabulary is going down. Despite the best schools in the world, we are losing the war. Why? Because this is not about pedagogy. This is about attachment. Children speak, talk, learn the language from those to whom they are attached. They take on the same form. And so children take on the same form. They walk like, talk like, dress like. They carry the demeanor of. They adopt the form of, adopt the values of. And so as education, we are trying to shoehorn them into society, but our children, instead of following us, are following each other because their attachments have become to each other. And so they talk like each other, act like each other, and it's becoming more difficult to teach these children because the attachments are not going in a right way. But this is only phase two. By phase three, by the third year of life, it should occur to a child that the way to hold mommy close is to possess her, to not let anything get in between. No, I'm not talking about your spouse here, but this is very significant in marriage as well. You see, and all in friendships, this possessiveness, this jealousy and all of this. And this is very strong in terms of belonging. But on the heels of this is another way of closeness. That closeness is to be on the same side as, to take the same side as, to agree with, to keep out of trouble, to make things work for, to serve and to obey. Very old words, but all part of the loyalty instincts. And this creates a context in which you can be able to raise a child, whether as a parent or as a teacher. But this is the context. This is about attachment in this way. But this context is necessary in which to raise a child. And many children are not falling properly into attachments with their parents. And the fourth thing is by a child enters the fourth year, it should occur to a child that mommy and daddy hold close that which they hold dear. And so the child wants to become dear to his parents, to matter to them, to be significant to them. And so he tries to do things to make himself more endeared. And the personality turns a bit to the sweet, to be nicer, etc. And this is all part of the process. Now, when you want to matter to somebody, you can easily get hurt by any sign of not mattering. And so it gets more and more difficult as we move further down. But notice here, the child is supposed to move down further, deeper in it. Now, the fifth one is key. It's pivotal. This is absolutely pivotal to human development, to natural development. The fifth phase is when the limbic system, the emotional brain, pulls out all the stops. and just takes great risks in terms of full emotional involvement. And now the child gives his heart to those to whom he is attached. I love you, Mommy. And now the cards are full of hearts, full of drawings. If he likes the kitten before, he now loves the kitten. You know, it's just he gives his heart away. And the word for this, probably the best word for this, is love. The child becomes emotionally involved. I continually would ask parents. They would come to me with their problems over the years, learning problems, achievement problems, academic problems, problems in raising the child. And I would say, well, when did the child give you his heart? Well, what do you mean? Well, when did you see that, feel that deep emotional connection? When did the child say, I love you in the most deep meant way, not as an imitation, but in this way? Well, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about his behavior. How do I get him to be good? How do I get him to put away his things? How do I get him to achieve at school? And I would say, well, if he hasn't given you his heart, you have no context in which to raise him. I could not be the father my children need. I've written books. But I'm known as Canada's expert on parenting. I taught parent-child relations for years at university. I go and I address thousands of teachers across the world. This does not make me a better parent. Unfortunately, not. To be a good father to my children, to be a good grandfather to my three grandkids, I need their hearts. Because that is the context in which to raise them. This is the womb of maturation. And if they are going to realize their full potential as human beings, they need to be able to give me their heart. This is the womb of maturation. There needs to be this emotional involvement. Our concern now is that children are not falling deeply into attachment. They do not have a continuous attachment. This takes time. This takes years, not months. Years to develop the kind of attachment. And if the womb is not developed, the fruit is not developed. And this is the problem. A child needs to be deeply rooted. And if everything goes well and the child gives his heart, within about a year, it occurs to that child to share that which is within his heart. And now he wants to be known. He tells his secrets to. He interprets closeness by being known. Many students today, if you ask them, and I ask students all over the place, who are you close to and why? And the less they show the characteristics of a good learner, the more they answer. I ask them, who are you close to and why? And they answer so and so and so and so. Why? Because we hang together, because we're with each other, hang out together, and because we're alike. This is not the answer you'd want. And more children show the signs of maturation, adaptive, emergent, and integrative functioning, the more they define when you ask them, who are you close to and why? You know, they answer in terms of emotional intimacy and psychological intimacy, because she's the one I tell my secrets to. She's the one who knows me best. She's the one who listens and understands. And so we have a full womb of maturation. Now, nature knows what it's doing. This is remarkable. Nature knows what it's doing. It knows that by 6 years of age, if everything unfolds, a child will have five different ways of holding on to mom and dad when physically apart. That is, from the natural design, it shows us that children need this continuous kind of attachment, like a plant needs not to be transplanted until its roots are somewhat developed and enough ground that is there needs to develop. It needs to be able to develop and give your heart to mom and so that, or dad, and so that when you go to school, you seek automatically the teacher to connect with rather than the peers. But today's children are automatically coming out of this. We put them together at such a time when they're all the energy is out of sameness and it occurs to them that they should attach to each other. This is part of our problem with early interaction with peers, is it forwards all of this interaction. And so the deeper a child is attached, the more they can separate. Now, we used to think that given a child should be attached for the first 3 years and then they could be too attached. They need to separate in order to grow up. Think of how ridiculous this would be in terms of the plant analogy. You know, The plant needs to practice separating. We pull it out. We stretch it. We practice every day opening the blossoms and the blooms. We stretch it this way. Well, we'd pull it right out from the roots. A child can't be too attached. A child can be too superficially attached, too insecurely attached. You can't be too attached to your husband and wife. The more deeply attached you are, the more you can handle separation, differences, disagreement, not mattering all the time, and even falling out of love, if at least you are each other's best friends. You can't be too attached. You can be too superficially attached. And the more attached you are, the more room for your individuality. Adolescent doesn't separate from parents to grow up. The adolescent needs deep-rooted attachments to be able to do this. And this takes time. This takes time to develop. This is the most significant in cultures and traditions which honor the fact that children need to fall into attachment, produce the fruit of maturation, and then as a society, we can capitalize on this fruit. But we need a wonderful partnership with the home. We need a wonderful partnership with the home to be able to do this. What interferes with developing a deep attachment? What is it that interferes with it? Well, first and foremost, not enough time for continuous connection. This takes time. This takes time. It takes time where the roots are not disturbed. They are not disturbed. And fear of separation and getting hurt. As soon as a child is afraid of separation, of not belonging, of insignificance, as soon as a child becomes afraid of losing, and as soon as a child becomes fear of getting hurt, the energy draws out to the more superficial attachments. Because the deeper the attachment, the more vulnerable. If you give your heart away, you risk it being broken. And so this becomes necessary in terms of it. And a loss of tender feelings. Our children are showing, again, an escalation of a lack of, they no longer, many of them say, I miss or I'm afraid or I feel sorry. They're missing the tender feelings of sadness and disappointment. And this is due to human fragility, that we are very, very fragile as human beings. This is the result of understanding of classical psychology and now reaffirmed in neuroscience, is that we're easily wounded and our brain does not stand idly by if the vulnerability is overwhelming. And it raises defenses. And the first defense are emotional filters in the limbic system. And a child loses his feelings. But if he loses his feelings, he loses his interest and curiosity. And so he is not interested. If he loses his feelings, he loses his sadness, and so he's no longer adaptive. And if he loses his feelings, he loses the integrative process. And so we now know that the engine of maturation is emotion. It's emotion. We used to think it was stimulation and early experience. Now we know it's emotion. The child has to have the right feelings for even the brain to develop. And those feelings come in the context of warm, fulfilling attachments. There's a backup strategy that the brain will use, simply not to let the child see anything that would make him feel bad. And so this is increasing as our children are showing signs of perceptual blindness, defensive blindness, where they don't see anything. They have no memory for bad things happening. And they can't see trouble coming. And these problems are escalating, often embedded in what we diagnose as attention deficit disorder. It really is underneath that the child can't see his mistakes, anything that would make him feel bad, and that this is largely involved in it. And now we also know the wounds. Through our studies of cortisol and how they affect the child in different experiences, we now know that the greatest wound to children is separation from those attached to, of all kinds, psychological, emotional, and so on, feeling as if there's something wrong with one, and being scared, feeling unsafe. These are the wounds. And there's good indication that our children, these experiences among our children are increasing. And if they're increasing, their defendedness is increasing. And there's much evidence that shows is that our children are in a flight from vulnerability. And I talk about this in the book. And if our children are in a flight from vulnerability, when they lose their soft hearts, they lose their ability to mature. When they lose their soft hearts, we have in our children in our school no longer curious and interested, considerate, and we're losing that place in their life. Why is this so? Why are they becoming more defended against vulnerability? Basically, one of the main reasons is because of premature separation from parents. What is meant by premature? What is meant by premature is premature separation is when a child is physically apart from parents when they cannot hold on. What is nature's answer to holding on? A deeper attachment. And so a child needs to be attached more emotionally. If a child is given his heart, it can withstand far more physical separation. So the earlier the separation, the more problems we have with children becoming wounded. With my wife, we had an opportunity to tour Jerusalem. I guess it was last week now, on Thursday. We were touring Jerusalem. I was speaking in Israel. And the rabbi showed us, he was this school in which children were from, what was it, 7 o'clock in the morning to 6:30 in the afternoon, something like this. I'm asking my wife over there to confirm my memory. It was there, and he said, look at them. You know, look how well they're playing and so on. They're like children everywhere in the world. And my heart sank from this. He was boasting because they could learn the Bible by heart. They could learn all of this. It was the best education in the world to learn Judaism and so on. And my heart just sank for these children because I said, well, just, just let me ask them. I would just, can these children move from mad to sad? Are they interested in curiosity, or are they just rote learners? Can they deal with inner conflict, or are they just indoctrinated? Because if they don't show these characteristics, yes, they are defended against vulnerability. Nature has to do this because they're in a wounding environment. They have experienced much too much separation. But this, like societies all along the world think, if we only teach children more, and we only teach children longer hours, and we only, teach harder and get more of it through their head, this will happen. This is not the answer. A school could be far more effective and efficient if we fostered the conditions in our society to give rise to maturation. And then it would take very little time to be able to teach children what it is that they need to know. We are just simply battling against symptoms. The problem is what we find out in neuroscience. When children face separation, it gives rise to the three fundamental emotions in our limbic system. Pursuit, children become preoccupied with contact and closeness, and we see that in their absolute obsession with attachment technology. They become frustrated, and this is the roots of aggression in our society, eruptions of foul frustration, and they become alarmed. And this is the result of both underneath anxiety, agitation, and including the adrenaline problems in our society, and more students are seeking adrenaline rushes, and more adolescents are cutting themselves. And this is an indication of high rise of this. And if the separation still can't be faced, is too invulnerable, it gives rise to other problems. Children reattach to others, and that gives rise to the great pure orientation we have in our society. Children, it's not safe to depend, so they take on an alpha personality, bossy, prescriptive, telling their parents what to do, always having to be in control. And we're having an escalation of alpha personalities among children and needing to defend, to numb out and to tune out. And so this is all a result of this. I teach a course, a whole week course of 20 hours on all the impact of separation as we draw all the evidence together in science this problem. So the loss of tender feelings, one, because of premature separation from parents, two, because of being subjected to wounding environments. Research shows us that peer interaction is a major source of wounding. Peer interaction is where today's child, not the family, as many societies thought they had to save children from society. In the 1960s and 70s, this was a great ideology. because of some bad parents, thought we had to save all children from this and that the state was safer than the family. No, the research is unequivocal that the single most factor in terms of wounding children is when they are with each other, because that is where they experience more rejection, not belonging, isolation, ostracization, all kinds of separation, emotional and physical, too much shame, you're stupid, something wrong with you. Children relate to each other all the time, rather insensitively, and feeling too unsafe. And so children are in wounding environments. And so when they're even 2 years of age, we put them in those wounding environments and the cortisol level goes way up. Why? Because they can't sustain that. We could hardly sustain that. When we're with our peers in interaction, when we do this, we could not sustain the environments we're expecting them to sustain. And so they become defended. And because it is increasing practice to use the relationship against the child, things like timeouts and separation, love withdrawal, these are using the relationship against the child. I'm glad this isn't the practice here in Sweden, and please don't import this from Canada and United States. This is dreadful. But the most common way of being able to deal with children, both in the school system and out of school system now, is using separation punitively. They withdraw the invitation to exist in their presence until the child is behaved. This is euphemizes timeouts and so on. And it is becoming incredibly popular as the main way. Many parents think this is the way you parent. And, of course, this is causing hardening, emotional hardening, and so on, a loss of tender feelings. And these children are becoming arrested in their development. These parents, and this is part of my job, is to be able to try and help them understand that there are other ways, more natural ways. So one more question here before we draw this to the first conclusion. There are a number of parts to this, but one more question here is then, how can a child come to feel fulfilled and thus temporarily released from attachment hunger? It turns out that attachment hunger is very much like physical hunger. Is that to get a child to be released, you don't practice going hungry, okay? That's not what you do. You don't practice, well, you know, now you've made it 2 hours, now try to make it 3 hours. You know? You don't practice this. This isn't something that you reward for the amount of time you can go without food. The way to release any child from food is to feed them. That is the way you release them. And the same thing, it is true in terms of attachment. The way you release a child from attachment is to be able to fulfill that. But it is a little bit more complicated than food, and hence I will walk around this construct. And you only release a child like physical hunger for hours. You only release for hours. It doesn't matter how much you feed them, but that child is right back hungry again. I notice Swedes only have about an hour and a half between hunger. I'm teasing you. I was teasing Jonas. I can't believe how much you can eat. I wish I could eat. Same when we were in France. I don't know. I have to learn how to do that. I'd love to eat all of that and not show the results. But it only allows freedom temporarily. In other words, there's no such thing as finally being freed from physical hunger. There's no such thing. And there's no such thing as being finally freed from attachment hunger. This is a very basic need for love and affection and significance and belonging and identity, a very basic need. So there's no such thing. And that's why it has to be answered in a relationship rather than in an event. It has to be answered in a relationship rather than an event, because it's the relationship in which this is met. How can a child come to feel fulfilled and thus temporarily released from attachment hunger? First of all and foremost, and the most significant, is the child must be attached to the one who is providing contact and closeness. Many teachers will come to me and say, well, I love my students. Yes, I know this is a good thing. However, it is irrelevant. The question is, do your students love you? Because if your students are not attached to you, there's no umbilical cord. You know? I have had parents who come to me, and I have consulted for parent overseas orphanage, for overseas adoptions, rather. And they have all the love to give to their child, all the love to their new adopted child. They spend thousands of dollars, spend years sometimes arranging an adoption from Romania or Georgia or China. And then they have all this love to give, and they bring the child home, and they come to me 2 years later, and the child is acting as if they are starving. They have all kinds of problems. Why is this a problem? I have all this love to give to this child. Yes, but that's not the issue. The issue is the child attached to you? Because the bottom line is that's the umbilical cord through which the child receives it. And so the child must be attached to those who are providing. This is one of the most important things. This is not a matter of this. In fact, when universities are sensitive to the teacher-student relationship, they call it wrong. They call it the teacher-student relationship. It's not that. It's the student-teacher relationship. When my book was being translated in different languages, it came back about talking about the parent-child relationship. I said, you didn't read the book. That's the whole point. It's about the child-parent relationship. That's what it is. It is about that. The child must be attached. And so the child must be attached to the one providing. The child must feel safe to depend upon and trust in the one who is providing their attachment needs. Attachment is wonderful, but it is very unswedish and un-Canadian. You in Sweden, like us in Canadian, we have a love affair with equality. We like all things to be equal. We don't like to be in any other arrangement but equal. And but attachment knows nothing about Swedish and Canadian ideology. And so attachment has a different way of doing things. And attachment is to be able to facilitate dependence, which is another dirty word in Sweden and Canada, because we like the word independence. You can see that attachment has a hard go of it, but science is not politically correct. And so when two people attach, what nature does is, because attachment is to facilitate this wonderful caretaking relationship of one to be receptive and one to assume responsibility. We call this the alpha and this the dependent, and that's what happens. And so the dependent is to seek a direction from, to follow, to look to for the answers, to take the cues from, to seek significance in the eyes of, and so on. It is like this. And the alpha is the answer, to be the answer to assume responsibility, to give directions, to take the lead. And so one is the answer to the other. And this is how all the universe of attachment is organized, be it pecking order in the jungle, be it with your pets, everything is organized in this way. So when two identical twins attach, and identical, they are equal in every way. But when they attach, nature says, we've got to arrange them hierarchically. And so in one twin, an alpha personality will develop, who has to be in charge, take control, assume responsibility, give the orders. And in the other twin, a dependent personality develops, because that's the only way they go together. And that is a story of attachment. Attachment is a story of this, because that's the way they go together. Now, the purpose of that is to create a womb where the child becomes a separate person, and then you relate to each other as a separate being. So equality is the fruit of attachment, but equality isn't, attachment itself is hierarchical. And so dependence is the first phase in which independence is born. And childhood is a time for dependence, and then for this relationship. And so to be able to inspire children to depend upon you, you cannot relate as if you're their equals, because if you do, they'll be on top of you all over. They will have to have the last word. They will become alpha, because nature doesn't know this. So you have to present as if you are the answer. You are the answer to their significance, to their bearings, you're the answer to their sense of belonging. You present, you're the answer, and it inspires dependence to lean upon, to trust it. And now you have a working relationship. In that working relationship, maturation will result. But this is what is necessary. Today's parents and teachers are losing this. They are so concerned about this. They are losing their ability to find their alpha, their best alpha personality, not to lord it over, but to be able to inspire their students to become dependent, to inspire their children to lean on them. And they need this presence. And this is the way, again, nature is organized. And so it organizes this so the child is receptive to being taken care of. We are having a generation of alpha children who boss adults around, tell adults what to do, who are very hard to direct, very hard to control. It doesn't feel right for them because they have alpha instincts that are highly evoked. They have not met adults in their life who inspire them to depend. It requires this kinds of present. This is the basic posture. This is the first item of business as you walk, if you're an educator, into your classroom, or you walk into your family situation. The first item of business is who? No, can I depend? And so you present in this alpha way. And we're losing this in our society. So children must depend upon and trust in the one who is providing for their attachment needs. Children must experience the provision as greater than the pursuit. This is very important. You see, just like physical hunger, you might provide for your child. You might provide every day. You have enough that they need. But maybe the child doesn't know that. Maybe they have overheard you and say that I'm concerned about being able to put the food on the table. We're not making as much as we used to. I'm very concerned about this. And then the child begins to feel in charge and insecure. In fact, you could put a banquet in front of them. But if the child feels as if they will not be that tomorrow or it could be taken away, the child no longer can take it for granted. All growth emanates from a place of rest. And that rest comes because the provision must be greater than the pursuit. In other words, if you've heard, in a sense, people say, well, don't look at him. He's only going for attention. Well, first of all, what else is there to go for? And why are you not seeing yourself as the answer? It's only the child can only be relaxed from pursuing attention if you give more than is needed. How do you get a child to be released from a hug? You know? Mommy, can I have a hug? Okay, here's a hug. Well, try that with your spouse. You know? Honey, can I have a hug? Oh, here's a hug. No, I need a hug. Okay, here's a hug. No. Whew. I need to hug me more, right? And then you hug more, and then finally, I needed you to think of it first. Why? Because the provision always had to be bigger than the pursuit. That's why when you bring your wife flowers, oh, no, we're in Sweden, gender equality. When you bring your husband flowers, okay? When you bring your husband flowers, and your husband asks for those flowers, first of all, he asks for those flowers and you bring them to him. They don't work because it had to be a surprise. Actually, this is very feminine psychology, so it doesn't work the other way around. I guess we're left with this, aren't we? Men of what I speak. The provision must be greater than the pursuit. Without that, the child never relaxes. Never relaxes. And the child must take for granted they are not the ones who have to be in charge of keeping mommy's love, daddy's significance, of mattering. They don't have to work at the relationship. The child must be able to rest in the provision provided. Must be able to rest in that. And the child must be emotionally tender enough to be able to feel empty. This is a very interesting thing. A child must be able to feel empty. Now, that's a very vulnerable place. Mom, I miss you. Daddy, I wish you were home. They must be able to feel that emptiness. I'm lonely. I'd like you. Can you come back? And very much to feel their emptiness, to be capable of feeling full. Now, many children can no longer feel their emptiness. They no longer say, I miss. They no longer say, I'm lonely. You can see that they do, but they don't say it. And when you've lost the ability to feel empty, you've lost the ability to feel full. Now, I worked with some children who couldn't even feel their physical hunger. And their physical eating was way off because they were so defended. They weren't able to do this. But at least their psychological hunger, and this requires a soft heart. It requires a soft heart. So the conclusion then, why are fewer children hungry to learn? The conclusion to this part, to be able to see it, the conclusion here is very simply because many children are not being released from their attachment hunger, thus rendering them preoccupied with contact and closeness, including attachment technology. School subjects are becoming more and more irrelevant to their felt needs. Okay? I'll say that again. Why are fewer children hungry to learn? Because many children, increasing in numbers, are not being released from their attachment hunger, thus rendering them preoccupied with contact and closeness, including attachment technology. School subjects are irrelevant to their felt needs. And this is where children don't have a hunger to learn when they are hungry for food, except to learn how to get food. Okay? Children don't have a hunger to learn when they are hungry for proximity, contact and closeness, love and affection, except to learn how to pursue and preserve proximity. And so we're having increasing number of students who are preoccupied with issues of belonging, of identity, preoccupied with issues of significance, of esteem, of mattering, of issues of sameness, of conformity, of staying in touch. These children are not particularly teachable. They can learn all right, but only learn how to pursue proximity or how to result in that. And so the subjects we want them to learn about the roots of democracy, about the history of Sweden, about natural history, about a green earth, about the values that are necessary to ensure a future generations, all of these things seem irrelevant to them. And it's so irrelevant that after they pass their exams, they forget it very quickly because it doesn't go deeply. And the answer is in terms of very simply, is we are not supporting in our society the attachment conditions, the what is necessary to create a fulfilling, deep attachment womb. Which is home business. We are not supporting sufficiently the home in which to create the attachment, which is the womb, which creates the characteristics of a good learner, so that when they come to the school system, it makes us look real good. Because when we've got good learners there, our results go way up. And it's not a matter of curriculum, it's not a matter of pedagogy, it's not a matter of technology, it's a matter of having good learners. Now, I have another question to address here before we take our break. I have another question to address. Is there a way for the school systems, a way for school systems to work around this problem? Now, can we work around this problem? Is there a way for us as a society in our educational systems to do this? Can we work around it? Now, and the answer is yes. Yes, there is, but only to a certain extent. To make school relevant, we would need to attach students to their teachers and harness the attachment processes to foster learning. We would need to lead them into learning because they are not leaping into learning on their own. We would need to lead them into learning because they are not leaping into learning on their own. Leading is an issue of attachment. We only follow those to whom we are attached. Now, the word pedagogue is a beautiful word. It literally means leader of children. Peda means children, like pediatrics and all kinds of things as children. And agog means leader, and so it's a leader of children. And the word has its origins in ancient Greece. And when the gymnasium, like you use here in Sweden, the word gymnasium, that was a name for their school in Greece, a gymnasium. And when the children went to school, the habit was in the home is the person who was leading them, usually the full-time nanny, who was leading the children. He would he or she would go in front of the children, and the whole children of the household would follow them to the gymnasium. And the term for that person became pedagogue. Who was leading them into learning. Now notice this wasn't the actual term for the teacher. This was a term for the one that they were attached to who led them there. But it's a beautiful metaphor because it's a metaphor that goes to the beginning, the very beginnings of the school system, and one we've lost is what is a true pedagogue? Yes, for those children who are curious and interested, can learn from their mistakes and can benefit from conflict, they don't have to be attached to us to learn. That is true. But their numbers are decreasing. For more and more children to lead them into learning, we have to be able to harness the power of attachment. We have to engage the attachment instincts. We have to be able to get into the attachment business. You say, well, but this was never meant to be the business of school. Well, in terms of pedagogue, it would appear to be so that it is. But even in the Greek, system, they had their problem students. They had their students in which they were their home had not given them sufficient maturation. When Socrates, the Socratic method, probably the best strategy ever in terms of teaching, when he, legend has, was confronted and he said, why did this student not learn from you if your method is so superior? Socrates is said to have shot back, I couldn't teach this student. He didn't love me. That's an incredible answer. That's incredible. Now, he could have said, and I think a full answer would be, I couldn't teach this student. He wasn't interested and curious. Okay? I couldn't teach this student. He could not deal with conflict. I couldn't teach this student. He couldn't learn from his mistakes. The only thing left I had was that he wanted to be like me. He wanted to be with me, and I didn't have that either. And so that would have been the full answer that Socrates gave. Now, that is 2,500 years ago almost, and that is the wisdom we need to recapture. At the very beginning, the relationship between society and home is that we support the home to be able to foster maturation and nurturance. Yes, absolutely we foster that home. But the next issue is for all of those who come into our school systems who do not have interest and curiosity, who do not are able to deal with conflict, who do not learn from their mistakes, those we have to collect. Those we have to harness the power of attachment. If we do this, we'll get the best benefit of both the traditional school systems in which original cultures are based and our advanced school systems upon which Sweden and Canada is based. We would have the best of two worlds. What does it look like in terms of attachment pedagogy? Well, all we have to remember is the immature, those who do not show the signs of a good learner. The immature are only inclined to follow those to whom they are attached. That is so basic. And so it means, and this goes beyond what I have time to cover here today, is that we need to engage, we need to establish relationship, rapport. We need to be able to do this, But let me just go through all the different angles the immature are only designed to attend to. In New York, we found that children in the 60s and 70s were not attending to their teachers. That was the origin of attention deficit disorder. It was called minimum brain dysfunction at that time. Teachers thought that there was something wrong with students because they weren't attending to them. And only to find out that New York, they had mass peer orientation problems. Children only attend to those to whom they were attached. They were no longer attaching to their teachers. And so they were no longer attending to their teachers. Ritalin has never been the answer to problems attachment. There is not one pill that can make us grow up. Not one. And if immaturity is a condition of our times, then medication is not the answer. It is, again, the wounds of attachment that can help children grow up. The immature only feel at home with those to whom they're attached. All over the world, we're having problems with absenteeism, with truism. In Japan, it is escalating. We have problems with this in Canada, United States. It's very simple. When I'm involved in consulting for school systems and education systems, I simply say, the child only feels at home with those to whom they're attached. Give me one teacher in high school who will take the effort to cultivate an attachment with this truant child. One teacher. And when the attachment is there, you will notice that child will come to school to be with that teacher. They will come home. That's all you have to do. And the research is so full of evidence that the answer to truancy is for children to become attached to their teachers. It is so simple. So simple. The immature only assume the form of, dress like, talk like. I was wonderfully attached to my Mrs. Ackerberg, my grade one teacher. And so I talked like her. She was British. My middle name is Arthur, and she called me Arthur. And I called myself Arthur for 5 years. And finally, I wrote a book because I thought that, that's not true. But they're only predisposed to talk like those to whom they are attached. Only feel like being good for. And this is so significant. We all want our children to be good. But the point is, we only feel like being good for those to whom we're attached. We're now finding out that children were born to be difficult. We shouldn't be surprised. By default, they are difficult. Why? Because by default, when you say to them, hurry, they slow down. When you say to them, you must do this, they don't feel like doing it. When you say to them, you have to learn, they don't feel like learning so much. By default, they are difficult because they were designed to only be receptive, to take the orders from those to whom they are attached to. And so that is why when I worked with delinquents, they were always saying, you're not my mother, don't tell me what to do. And the problem was, is these kids were not attached to those to whom we're giving directions. And that is another reason why. We need to know the difference between the maturing and the immature, the curious and the non-curious, those who learn from their mistakes and adaptive, have their sadness, and those who don't. And those who don't, we have to throw the net of attachment out to catch them. They are going to fall through the cracks in increasing numbers in our systems and make us look very bad as they're beginning them too, because our school system is going to, no matter how perfect it is, we're going to have to throw the net out for these. And so there's two answers to this question. Is can we teach the immature? Yes, we can, but through the process of attachment. So there's two answers in society. To support the home, to be able to foster good learners, the maturation process, children move deeper into attachments. And the second one is to be able to take a tactical retreat into attachment. Children are most inclined to agree with those to whom they are attached. And it's very nice to teach students who agree with you. Most likely to take direction from those to whom they are attached. Only open to influence, and teaching is an influence business. You are trying to open a child up to think, to consider things, and that is it. And a child is only, we can only open their minds when we have won their hearts. We must win the hearts of the immature to be able to open their minds to what we want to teach them. They only seek to measure up to the expectations of those to whom they are attached. And so the answer to this is yes, we can do this. Yes, we can do this. But in terms of to do this, we've got to get into the attachment business. Now, I had another question I was going to address, and I'm going to need some help here on whether I start this question now or whether I wait until after our break. I'll need some help. We'll have a break now? Okay, then I turn it over to you, and I'll leave this for after. Thank you. Okay, how do we think with a full stomach? How do I teach with a full stomach? That rhubarb was delicious. The whole meal was delicious. So I was going to address another question here. But before I address, just let me reiterate again. Why are fewer children hungry to learn? And the answer in following that argument, the answer to that is because many children are not being released from their attachment to hunger, thus rendering them preoccupied with contact and closeness, including attachment technology, as school subjects are irrelevant to their felt needs. And the picture that we gave here that collects all the evidence and looks at the picture is of that attachment is the womb of the maturing processes. Maturation is spontaneous but not inevitable. It means that the potential is in every child to become curious and interested, to be able to process inner conflict, to be able to adapt to the things that they cannot change, learn from their mistakes. Every child has this potential, but there is no guarantee that it is realized. And if it is realized, this potential can be realized, then this child can benefit from social experience, can benefit from schooling, can benefit from instruction, that this is the key. And that the home, as we said, produces good learners, and then the school can teach these children. But the school cannot teach them to be curious and interested. There's no way to do this. The school cannot teach them to process conflict. There's no way to do this. The school cannot teach them to learn from their mistakes. This is to be growing. And the conditions that are conducive for growth, the conditions that are conducive for maturation, are in the answer is in the context of deep, fulfilling attachments with the adults who care for them. Deep, fulfilling attachments. That this is the answer. This is the key. And we outlined then what does a deep attachment look like? How long does it take an attachment to begin to develop the full capacity to, ideally? Fortunately, it's never too late, the earlier the child can develop that attachment, the better. And that attachment, a fully developed attachment, is much more nurturing. And like a plant, the more deeply rooted, the more nurturing the attachments, the more fulfilled the attachments, the more growth you see. The more growth you see, the more schoolable a child, the more teachable a child. And so there is this relationship between the home and society in which the good learner is grown and then can benefit from schooling. And so this is the model that makes sense of the data, of the evidence. When we put it together, research can only generate certain facts, but we have to have a model to explain those facts to be able to put it together and from which we get implications. And so as simple as it is that children cannot learn. Thank you. Children cannot learn on an empty stomach. Children also cannot learn when their attachment needs are to the fore. When their attachment hunger is not fulfilled, they're all about attachment. They're all about contact and closeness. They're all about connection. They're all about significance. And today's children are seeking that in the arms of each other. I'm going to deal with that particular problem after the debate and after our afternoon break. I think it is about 3:30. I'll focus on the issue of peers and the prevailing attitudes there. But the question is cannot peers meet the attachment needs of each other? That is the idea, that they belong to each other. They can get a sense of fitting in, a sense of being normal, of not being different than each other. There is the prevailing attitude that is where they must get their esteem needs met. All of this is predominant in our society, and we're completely blinded by something, I don't know which, and uninformed in this case by developmental science. And this is the theme of my book, and I speak about this in this book, this great blindness in which we see peers as being the answer to this. But there is another question that I want to address now in the time we have, just a little bit less than half an hour before we have the debate. There's another question, and this question but aren't trained caregivers and teachers able to answer a child's attachment needs? Can't those who are educated in how to take care of children and who are taught how to teach children, can't they do this? Are parents really necessary in the scheme of things? Can't we take over for the family? Isn't it possible? Cannot the state assume the responsibilities of the family? There is a movement within Europe, a very strong movement of defamilization, of thinking that the state even can do better than the family in many areas. It can care for children better, and it can teach children better, and so on. So there is that thought that is there. Aren't trained caregivers and teachers able to answer the basic needs of a child and raise children, provide the context for raising children? And so I try to put it here, the prevailing assumption in European as well as North American society among many, especially guided by ideology, is that children's needs can be met by adults who are professionally trained to take care of them. This assumption comes largely from post-industrialized nations, and so I call it outdated because it was based on a role-based society, not on relationship-based. This is a particular assumption that is in post-industrialized nations, as Sweden is, as Canada is, as most of the European nations is. And so this outdated assumption is completely uninformed by contemporary developmental science. Now, I want to go again and look at the slides, the points that I presented in the morning to take a look at this. And you look at this and we say, well, how can a child come to feel fulfilled and thus temporarily released from attachment hunger? This is absolutely necessary for a child to become teachable, interested and curious, able to handle conflict, learn from dissonance, be able to learn from their mistakes. How is this possible? How is this possible? So how can a child do this? And we say, well, the child must be attached to the one who is providing. This is essential. In other words, in a post-industrialized society, we think of roles. Even parents think of roles. I have this role. A role is a certain set of responsibilities in society. The role may be to take care of children. The role may be to teach children. The role may be to manage their behavior, to supervise children. That is a role. And all post-industrialized society is organized into roles. We have the consumer. We have the doctor. We have the patient. But attachment, this is not how humans have evolved. Humans have evolved in terms of attachments, and that attachments are the context in which children need to be raised, not roles. So here we have a problem. As society educates for a certain role of a doctor, let's say, prescribes, certifies, regulates, and along comes a child who is sick and needs to be treated. So the doctor has the role, has the proficiency, all of this kind of thing. But here's a problem. The child is shy, doesn't want the doctor to touch him, doesn't answer any of his questions, can't do any of this. Why? Because the child cares nothing about the role of the doctor. The child is only, the working has to do with whether the child is attached. This is a relationship. And so the doctor, if he's going to get anywhere at all, the teacher, if she's going to get anywhere at all, has to establish a working relationship with the child. In other words, has to establish a relationship to be able to fulfill his responsibilities. The same is the fact with an adopted parent, an adoptive parent, or a foster parent. In a foster parent, the government says, we'll take this child away from this parent, who is not very good, and give it to this parent, who has volunteered to take other people's children and to be more benign in their taking care of. Well, here's a problem. This foster parent can go to parenting courses, can have a university degree in caring, can be professional and the greatest quality whatsoever. But that's not the issue. The issue is the child attached to that person, as I was explaining. Oh, I could be certified by most, I taught parent-child relations. I wrote a book on this. I'm known as Canada's expert in parent-child relations. But that doesn't help me with my own children. With my own children and grandchildren, they need to be attached to me for me to be the father or the grandfather that they require. And so this is fundamental. And this is a basic misunderstanding in our society that we can simply prescribe roles. You are this person's teacher. Excuse me, says the child. I'm not attached to you. No? And that's why substitute teaching is so difficult. Because if you're teaching, especially with the immature, and the substitute teacher can be an expert teacher with a PhD, know everything there is to teach, but it only works if the students are attached. And, of course, the substitute teachers, foster parents, adoptive parents, are a great disadvantage. And so our caregivers, no matter how trained they are, because the bottom line is the child must be attaching. The child may resist attaching because of a number of reasons. One of the reasons is shyness. And this is a huge reason. The way attachment develops is by 5 months of age, after the brain has given 5 months of age for the child to form his working attachments. In traditional cultures, the infant is passed around during the first 5 months so they can get the smells, the sense of those who are going to be raising them. This idea that a child requires a village to raise them. This idea is being very much misunderstood. It suggests that we can farm out our children to strangers to raise them. This is not right, that the whole concept of a village. What a village means, it comes from the word actually as home, and it can equally be hamlet or home. And this means a place of attachment. It does not mean a place where other people start taking care of the child. And so in the African village, where the saying came, they have rituals in which the children become attached to those who are going to be involved in raising them. And so, and they need to do this, like in Celtic origins, they need to do this fairly quickly, because by 5 months of age, the child will develop what we call stranger protest. That is, when somebody approaches the child, if I have Sinead, my granddaughter, in my arms and somebody approaches, she will go away. It doesn't feel right to look at, to smile at, or to talk to those whom you're not attached to. By 2 years of age, this develops into full-blown shyness. And it's nature's way of shutting it down, saying, excuse me, I've got my village, thank you. I've got my attachments. Now it's time to develop depth. Now I need to fall into attachment, into likeness, into significance, into belonging, into loyalty, into love, and into being known. Now I need to do this. And so the automatically resistance, and this is huge, is that shyness means that a child now becomes automatically resistant to forming new attachments. It is our way of knowing that the family was part of the design in terms of this. Now, are there ways of getting around it? Yes, there are ways of getting around it. But you have to do this carefully. It means that the way you can get around it, and I demonstrate this all the time with new mothers and so on, and say, is your child? Yes. Well, okay, let's demonstrate. And I show them, and when I approach and try to get the child's eyes and smile and nod, there is shyness, there is resistance, and so on. And I say, watch this. And then I say, okay, I'm not going to put any pressure on the child. Now I'm going to talk to you as if we're attached. I want you to smile at me lots of eye contact, and we're going to talk. When you even talk nonsense, but we're going to talk and smile and nod like this. We're going to do this for 2 minutes. As the child observes us, and as a child observes us, then now I'm going to go back and I'm going to try and get the eyes, the nod, and the smile of your child. And suddenly it's much easier. I said, I've just introduced you to the most important thing in the world, the introduction. Is that in attachments beget attachments. Once the attachment is made to mom and dad, they are meant to be in the fore. They are meant to introduce that child to everyone that's going to be involved in their care and their teaching. And if they don't, it will lead to competing attachments when a child can't keep them both close at the same time. And so then, the more a child attaches to school, the more they may detach from home. So we have a problem. And so we somehow have to get this introduction going. Now, unfortunately, some intuitive teachers do this, some intuitive systems, but this is not informing our policy in Canada, and I believe in Sweden. This is not informing our policies of how we do school and how we do daycare. That doesn't mean that some can't be intuitive. Children also tend to attach to those whom they're most with, and where their attachment energy is going. So that means if the attachment energy is going into sameness, it occurs to them that they belong with those that they look alike, which will favor their peers. And when they move to attach to peers, it pulls them out of orbit from around the adults in their life. So we find that the more social, again, in our research, we find that the more social a 3- and 4-year-old is with their peers, the more problems they are to manage by the adults in their life. And so it because they're being pulled out of orbit. So our thinking, we think, oh, this child has made great progress. They're no longer shy with their peers, but now they're resisting contact and closeness with their adults. And that is interfering with their attachment. And so the child must be attached to. It doesn't mean we couldn't do this, but we would need to do it, being informed by a child's need for attachment. Caregivers and teachers are less likely to collect the children in their charge in order to foster working attachments. Now, why is this? Because caregivers and teachers are operating out of a role. They are assigned a role. They are assigned responsibilities, curriculum, instruction, caregiving. They are assigned that role. You would have to have very intuitive caregivers and teachers who knew that they had to create the context of relationship to be able to fulfill their responsibilities. So most teachers and most caregivers will get directly to work. Put away this now. Don't be disruptive. Come on, be nice. It's time to read this book, this assignment, and they'll get right down to this. Well, children don't work that way. As I said this morning, if you say to them, hurry up, they'll slow down. If you say to them, do this, they'll work to rule. They resist. Why? Because they need to be collected. They need to be collected. This is the basic way of in attachments. And in non-industrial nations, they don't work by roles in peoples, and they work by relationships. So if you went down to Provence and you tried to go to the market and you'd say, I'd like this fish, please, and I'd like these fresh vegetables, please, you'd get the rotten fish and you'd get the bad tomatoes and you'd get the bad cheese. Why? Because Provence is not a post-industrialized nation. It has no factories except perfume and soap, and those have been there for eons, but it's non-industrialized. Well, what difference does that make? They don't understand roles. They don't care if you are the consumer, because they don't operate by those rules. Unless you approach in the market the Provençal, the person who's selling the fish, and you get their eyes, and you get a smile, and you get a nod, You don't have a working relationship. Now, we call the French rude and arrogant because we can't get very good stuff from them. They call us barbaric because we don't know our manners. We don't know our manners. Why? Because like Swedes, like Canadians, start conversations like, excuse me, can I have this? And we get right to work. Now, maybe you don't say, excuse me. In Canadians, we always apologize for existence first, you see. And then we think that is enough and we can continue on. But we think we can go to work. No, nature is not like this. You can't go to work. You've got to collect first. Now, some intuitive teachers and caregivers, they're wonderful. Before they try to change the diaper, before they try to give, they get the eyes, they get the smile, they get the nod, and they engage the attachment instincts, and it goes easy. Before they try to feed the child, they do so and do this. And then the stomach works better because it's in the context of relationship. And all of our research shows that children are meant to be raised in the context of attachment. Now, could we do this? I think we could, but we would need to be informed by a lot of education. The problem is intuition is knowledge without words. And you could have 20 intuitive teachers in a school, but it not inform any policy because nobody knows has a language to pass it on. We now need a language to be able to inform us. We need, it is true, we are in a society now where we farm out our children to be raised. We have many players, but now we have to recreate the village in which to do this. And so we have to find a way. We have to find a way to do this. But if we just leave things as they are, then we're going to have huge troubles, as we're having. Caregivers and teachers are less likely to bridge all separations in order to preserve a working attachment. Well, what do you need to preserve attachment? Very simply, how do you preserve attachment? Is you bridge anything that would come in between. The most important thing is physical separation. And so when you say goodbye to your spouse, to your child, if you have any intuition at all, you always put the focus on the connection. I'll see you then. We'll give you a call then. I'll be back here. And you always bridge it because that's the way you preserve a relationship. This is called the goodbye ritual. And the other one was the greeting ritual. And these are the basis of any civilization that is based on attachment. You have your greetings, and then when a relationship is important to you, you bridge anything that could come in between. You have to be very careful about this, including problem behavior. I have teachers who ask me over and over again, well, what do you say to a child who's disruptive and misbehaving and who is doing something that interferes with the learning atmosphere of the child? And I say, well, if you throw the infraction flag, if you say to the child, this is not the way to express your frustration, then you better very quickly say something that bridges that problem behavior. You have to say, we're okay, I'm still your teacher, I'm looking forward to reading your poetry after. You have to put some focus on this, because if you don't, you run at risk of breaking the relationship because you're not holding on to the child. In English, my book is called Hold On to Your Children, and it speaks to this very important part that if you want to preserve a relationship, you have to mind your manners. You have to say your greetings, you have to collect, and you have to say your goodbyes. You have to bridge anything that would come in between. That child must know that nothing is going to separate them from you. And so you have to put the focus on the connection. Now, again, it's not that teachers and caregivers can't do this, but oh my goodness, would we have a long way to go in our society until we became collectively conscious of this. And this is the concern. And it's also the concern that parents know that this is the way to do things. What interferes with developing a deep attachment? We took a look at what interferes with attachment, but what a deep enough attachment? This is the stuff we looked at. Not enough time of continuous connection. The problem is caregivers and teachers come and go. We don't have a continuity. We don't have a time where the child moves from senses to becoming with to becoming like, from becoming like to taking the same side as, from taking the same side as to being to mattering to being able to give their heart, and heart to being able to share that was within their heart. It takes time. Often in the in the caregiving system and education system, there's a constantly a fear of separation because you're always anticipating that this is going to be over. There's not the continuity that is there. It moves on. How are we going to address those kinds of issues? And, of course, the big thing is the loss of tender feelings. When a child loses his tender feelings, when he can no longer say, I miss, when he has not his heart to give away, then we're going to have problems. And the problems is in both our daycare system as well as our educational system, the very fact that the child goes there involves premature separation. And we look at the effects of premature separation, we can see the problems with this. Because the child has experienced separation, there's frustration, there's alarm, there's evoking alpha dominance issues, transference of attachment and defendedness and numbing. And then the interaction usually is full of peers. It's peer rich and adult poor. And so it's the opposite kind of environment a child needs. As we said this morning, peer interaction is a major source of wounding in our children's lives. And so we have problems that in this context, children develop defensive armor because they're being prepared for a wounding environment. Now, it does. They look okay. They look okay because when you ask a child to talk about his troubles, he doesn't. He no longer talks about what distresses him. If you ask him if he's sad, he says no. He appears to be happy. The kids that I dealt with in the prison system were the happiest kids of all. They had no memory for bad things happened. There was no sadness. There was no grieving. They were happy-go-lucky, and they were dreadful shape. So when you see, okay, let's ask children, was there anything that troubled you today? It's the defended child who says no. It's the healthy child who can tell you all the things that went wrong. Does something make you sad today? It's a defended child who never feels sad. It's a healthy child who's full of stories about the things that didn't work. You see the irony. The irony. And when you get sociologists doing research that are totally uninformed by developmental psychology, they're always looking for the wrong things. They look for self-confessed happiness. You get that most in the prison and the orphanage. That's where you get it. But if you know anything about emotional health, which sociologists rarely do, and you scratch beneath the surface and see, can this child feel his sadness about the things that do not work? Can he say, I miss? Is there any indication that he has, that he can have his tender feelings? Is there emotional health there? Is there a modicum of curiosity and interest? Can he deal with inner conflict? These children flunk. And so that's why the reason is to know what it means to be healthy. And so we have a problem, is we have research that says these kids are doing very fine. They are not shy. They're this. But no, they have become defended so they can function in wounding environments. Nature isn't dumb. It will do what it is necessary to be able to protect a child and preserve vital functioning, but at great cost. The great cost of survival is always maturation, the realization of human potential. So if our question is this child moving to realize his full potential? That's a different question. Is this child capable of handling themselves in wounding environments? Does he ever talk about what distresses him? No, he doesn't. Well, he's capable of doing in wounding environments, but my goodness, the cost is huge. And the cost is also in the attributes to be a good learner. Now, back to the conditions required to create the kind of fulfilling attachments that creates good learners. So we go back to this. A child must feel safe to depend upon and trust in the one who is providing for their attachment needs. This would mean, of course, that we would have adults who presented in an alpha position, as if they were the answer to their children, the answer to their significance and their belonging, the answer to their need for contact and closeness. This requires a rather parental attitude, not one that caregivers and teachers are accustomed to doing. They have a job to do, but there's a resistance to thinking that their parents are locus, that they're actually substituting for the parent, which, of course, is is what you needed to do. And if the grandma type caregiver who actually approaches the child as if they're the answer to belonging, to affection, to significance, is going to have much more success at being able to attract the child to depend and trust in them. And so adults would need to present themselves as being the answer to the child's attachment needs. Caregivers and teachers are much less likely to invite a child to depend upon them. And caregivers and teachers, for two reasons, are allergic to dependence. One is we're in a society, as I said this morning, that's in love with independence. By the time a child is 3 years of age, we operate by the modus operandi. Don't expect me to do anything for you that you could or should do for yourself. If we ever treated our spouse this way, we'd have a marriage breakup in a very little time. Why? Because marriage is about attachment, and it's an unabashed invitation. I will take care of you. You can lean on me. You can depend upon me. In marriage, it's reciprocal. In with children, it's unrequited. It's one way. But unless we approach a child in that kind of generosity, but we have our professionals are afraid of their children depending upon them. They're afraid that if they give it an inch, it will take a mile. They're afraid of reinforcing it, and so there's resistance. We know that in the research, we know that when you resist children depending upon you, that doesn't cause independence. They simply take their dependency needs to their peers. And that is a worse scenario. As long as children are dependent, they need to depend upon those who are responsible for them. This is not our attitudes as professionals, as educators. We can train adults in how to care and how to teach, but we cannot motivate them to care for a child or to take care of them. This is a function of attachment, not role. Now, we have been doing this for thousands and thousands of years. Like other organisms, we have been doing this. Part of the instincts that I explained this morning, of the alpha instincts, when you attach to a child and you attach in the right mode, the alpha, part of what the instinct is to take care of the child, to be the answer to their attachment needs, to invite them to depend. And so this, you are moved to do this. A mother hen is moved to do this. A wolf is moved to do this. They are moved to take care. These are the instincts to take care. Now, this is a matter of attachment, not education. In education, you can teach somebody how to care. Let me give you an example. If you have a two-year-old child and he has a baby sister, now you put the baby sister in his lap, and let's say you do matchmaking. Oh, he's so lucky to have you as a big brother. Oh, look at her looking at you with adoring eyes. Oh, you're going to be wonderful with her. And you just matchmake so that two-year-old feels that he is the answer to his baby sister. And you just see the alpha rise within him. And he moves to take care of his baby sister. Now, he's moved to care for her, but the care may be very uninformed. He may hold the baby upside down. He may do all kinds of things. At least he's moved to care, but he doesn't know how to care. Now, when we do research on 14 and 15-year-old mothers, very young mothers, and the tradition is to teach them how to care for their babies, but we've had great problems this way. We can teach them how to change the diapers, how to nurse, how to recognize, but we have great problems. And the research I talk about in my book, we compare them to another group of mothers that we simply matchmake, like I explained to you, put the baby in the mother's arms and say, oh, the baby's so lucky to have you. Oh, you are going to be the best mother in the world. And we find within that mother the answer to her baby, and she attaches in the alpha mode. Give me that baby, and she knows where that baby is, and she all of a sudden does the things that mothers have been doing and fathers have been doing for thousands of years. Why? Because it's part of our own intuition. Now, is there room for showing a young mother how to take care of the baby? Of course, but you first of all have to have a mother who's motivated to take care, and this is a matter of relationship. not of education. This is a matter of relationship. And unless we facilitate this, we had a dark age in Canadian foster care in which we actually said to foster parents, don't get involved with your children. Don't let them attach to the children because you don't want to be too involved. It's going to make you too emotional. And we still have that attitude among teachers and caregivers. Don't take your job home with you. Don't get emotionally involved. Well, you can't be involved with children without giving your heart away. If you try to do that, you're not going to be a good caregiver. You're not going to be a good teacher. You may be able to do this with adults, but with children, you've got to be involved. And when you get involved, you are motivated to care for them. And we need a climate in which this happens. A child, as we said, must experience the provision as greater than the pursuit, but then one has to come as generous. Always giving more than is needed, more attention, more sense of significance, more mattering, more connection. And professionals are notorious for attending to the squeaky wheel. Because they're burnt out, because they're overwhelmed, they have too many children, too many people to take care of. They can only respond to that which is most demanding. This is no way to satisfy the needs. We need generosity. Again, this is very difficult to do in the public sector. It's difficult to do in the family, but at least there's more intuitiveness around it. A child must be able to rest in the provision provided, know that they don't have to work for the love, for the recognition, to measure up. It has to be given free. This has to be given. Well, that's not the concern of the educator. The concern is about achievement, is about performance. It is not about relationship. Relationship is only the context. In the bottom line, we have to get someplace. Again, in the parents, the parents and grandparents and relatives, it should be, the bottom line. It doesn't matter what. It doesn't matter how you achieve, how you do in school, whether you win, whether you're the best. Nothing can separate you from my love. The relationship must be a sense that it is forever. It transcends ever. And again, who is better at this kind of thing? A child needs to be able to rest. And a child must be emotionally tender enough to be able to feel empty, as we said this morning. And when they're in wounding environments, this doesn't work very well because this is exactly where they have to become defended to be able to exist. That doesn't mean children can't exist in very wounding environments. Look at them in Africa. Look at them in the orphanage. I was consulting for an African orphanage in Burundi. 120 kids who lost every single one of their supporting family members. These were kids who had been kidnapped and by warlords and had been left and abandoned. And, these kids would play. These kids would do this. But then you scratch beneath the surface. And there was no, they never said I miss. They never said I'm sad. They never said, there was no indication of emotional health. You could not fulfill these kids. They were superficially attached. They wanted to be hugged and sit on your knee, but that was all it was. It never went deeper. Deeper, they were full of defensive detachment because they had suffered nothing than this. They were the wounded ones. They were the wounded ones. And again, they needed to be incorporated in the context of caring attachments in order to be healed. So a child, they were able to function in wounding environments, but how can they get their feelings back? And so, again, the conclusion we come to, that a child's parents and involved relatives are naturally positioned to be the best bet for fulfilling a child's attachment hunger, naturally positioned and thereby producing good learners. This, of course, the argument says, but some children need to be protected. Absolutely. That's always been the state's responsibility for those, but primarily to support, we need to also support so that in society we can support the family to do the job what family is meant to do, and it is meant to create a womb of attachment where we can fulfill a child's attachment needs and thereby create a student that is hungry to learn, curious and interested, able to learn from conflict, able to handle dissonance, able to learn from their mistakes. And then at school, we can deal with this child very well. This child is easy to teach. This child will be able to benefit well. The connection is more likely to be experienced as continuous for the parents. Parents and relatives are more likely to be attached to the child and so instinctively moved to take care of or take care of the child, for the child. And the child is already born attached to the mother, first of all physically and then even before being born, creating a natural foundation upon which to build. Well, that ends my comments here, and I think it is time for debate. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
What we thought we'd do next here is that I think there are many questions and ideas still from this now, so we let Dr. Neufeld have a question and answer sessions. So Jannike and Therese, they will go around with a microphone and help you to put your questions, and Gordon Neufeld will feel when that's enough, and then he will finish off. So he's finished by maybe 20 to 5 or something like that, and we'll finish off around that time.
Jag heter i alla fall Agneta Birgersson. I just want to check with you if I understood you right. Did you say that the fruit... Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay, sorry. Did you say that the fruit of proper attachment is equality?
Yes.
And that it cannot come from without, it has to come from within.
It has to come from within.
Okay, thank you.
It comes from within in two ways. Mm-hmm. It comes from within in terms of the emergent process, in that when a child becomes a separate being, and the more they become the separate being, the more they think for themselves, have their own feelings, and have their own boundaries, the more it spontaneously occurs to them that others are separate too. And so the regard for others comes only as they become separate beings, and this has to grow. This is a great concern because the spirit of democracy is disappearing in our youth. They are not lining up to vote. They do not understand the democratic rituals. And when you have traditions without the spirit, this is of great concern. And the other source of democracy is the integrative process, the ability to be able to have togetherness without loss of separateness, to be an individual yet to be live in community, to have integrity without the loss of diplomacy, to have a diplomacy. In Swedish, you have a very nice presentation, but the question is, are you really being honest? Because this is the issue. If you sacrifice integrity for diplomacy, this is because of neuroses. This means that your social being is greater than your integrity. And what the integrative process does, we can teach children to get along, but we cannot teach them again how to live in community, because that's not what it means. What it means is to be able to be separate individuals, to have togetherness without the loss of separateness, diplomacy without the loss of integrity, integrity without the loss of diplomacy. You can't teach this. This has to be grown. And that, too, is a result of the integrative process. So the roots of democracy lie in maturation, not social experience. Social experience is where you see the manifestations of it, but that's not where it comes out. We make a huge mistake in thinking in our preschool, and because all the things, when sociologists study preschool, they say that it's good for children because look how social they become. What they don't understand are children are transferring their attachments to each other, and what you're seeing is attachment behavior and the loss of shyness. And there's a backfire to this is because it competes with the family. They're pulled out of orbit from around their siblings. They're pulled out of orbit from around their parents and their grandparents. And so what is interpreted as very positive is actually the last thing you want to see. We don't want increased sociability among our children. We want them to be shy to preserve their attachments so that their attachments in the context, they can grow up. And shy children finish much better. And the reason research, those that are shy and have preserved their family attachments have much greater maturation, but they don't appear very sociable. But the most ones who are most sociable are street children, and those are the worst off. And so it's backwards to what we think. But because sociologists do our research about preschool and daycare, they're the ones who are saying that this is so great for children. And if it's all the research is ever demonstrated by developmental psychologists or interpreted by me, it turns out completely different. And then there's a whole different idea about this, is that there's no evidence that there's benefit except from homes where it's chaotic. Then there is benefit, but that benefit actually runs out by grade 3, and by grade 4, it turns the other way. And so the benefit is short-term, not long-term, and so that research has to be taken into consideration.
Hello. Now you got me confused. I was thinking in Swedish, but actually I'll do it in English. Because that's my mother tongue.
Yeah.
But just as a comment to this, what you were saying, this socialization, it just struck me that, and I've heard this many times, that the concept of socialization here, I think, if I've understood it correctly, is to do what you said, to become sociable.
Yes, to become sociable.
And that's the whole sort of part of the purpose of the daycare system here.
Yes.
Is to get people to work in groups and be in groups and be able to communicate
right.
in groups.
That's so what's touted as
so the whole
success.
System seems to be focused on peer
on
attachment.
On sociability,
and it's
yes.
built into the system. Whereas, I remember thinking, being socially trained, that was something else in my mind.
Yes.
You know, but which has another connotation.
Yes, yes. The way we would use socialization process in its very basic meaning is to render fit for society, to become fit for mainstream society. That's what it means. But unfortunately, in the English language, and I assume in other languages, socializing is so close to socialization that it appears that socializing is the way that you become fit for society. In actual fact, the research shows the more one interacts with one's peers, the less fit for society. And so it goes the opposite of what we think. All the research shows that it's the opposite. Children who actually prefer to be with their parents, even in early teens, are much more likely to become rendered fit for society. So everything is the opposite of what it is being touted. But again, our research is not being informed by developmental science, because research has to be interpreted. All it does is generate facts. And then you go, well, what does this mean? What does it mean? And so it has to mean something. And so then, of course, people say, well, is this science? Is there basis? Well, no. How it's interpreted. Everything has to be interpreted. And if you interpret it without knowledge of attachment and so on, then it is saying something different than when it's interpreted through this way.
I remember a quotation from Olof Palme, who was the Prime Minister who was assassinated in 1986. Before that, at some point, he said something in his speech when he met some children at a school, that the purpose of them going to school was not for their own personal development, but to learn to work in groups.
Yes.
That was the clear message.
Yes.
Which must have obviously been repeated many other times in other contexts.
Yes, this is the John Lockean view in the 17th century, of the very strong view that school is basically the arm of society that is there to shoehorn children into society, and so there is some tension between families and society. But this is where developmental science comes along, and where the research is phenomenal, is those children who experience the longer, most deepest attachments with their parents actually have the best maturation and are most prepared to be able to interact with consideration with others. And again, as I mentioned, the research on the consideration of the average adolescent in Western civilization is on a nosedive, saying that we're doing something wrong.
Det blir på svenska.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jag har två små frågor. Du sa här att de barnen behöver mycket mer, att man ska ge dem mycket mer än de behöver av anknytning. Jag vet inte om det är en skröna eller inte, men jag har hört någonstans att det finns forskning som visar att hur bra barn klarar sig i skolan har jag med två faktorer. Dels mammans utbildningsnivå och amningstidens längd. Stämmer det? Det var den ena frågan. Sen undrar jag om du kan ge ett exempel på och förslag på hur man kan göra den anknytningen mellan lärare och elev. Förslag på hur den kan gå tillväga rent praktiskt.
Two questions. That's very hard on a male because I have to remember one while I think of the other. I'm aware of the fact that the mother's education is quite a determiner of the child's success and educational level. Yes. But the key would be what is the explanation? What is the explanation for this? And so this is we could look at it in different ways. There is a certain amount of belief in oneself and a belief in being able to open doors and open alternatives, a belief in the child to be able to do this, a belief in the child to not have that they are a learner. Like, there's various kinds of things. And so the question would be, well, what is the key? I wasn't aware of the nursing one. I love that. That's beautiful that the parent who takes the time and has the patience to be a true nurturer to the child and doesn't think that somebody else can do it better than them, would be this. I would say that this would probably more. I don't think that nursing itself has any indicator of this. Although it would, because in very very concrete terms, we find that when children are held with affection and when they're the eyes are meet, that the brain is just developing. So this is a wonderful connection happens in which the brain develops. And so that is true. But I think it's also indicative of the kind of person who would move into the nurturing the patient and value the relationship with the child is going to give exactly rise to the kind of context that the child will be a better learner. That's the way I would explain it anyway, is that research. I'm trying to hang on to your second question. Would you have the second question has to do with any advice for teachers. Yes, teachers. Well, the advice for teachers, and this is where I mainly speak to teachers. That's my main, I speak to thousands of teachers all over the world, and that's my main target audience is teachers. And there's two things I always say to teachers. Is one, support the role of the parents with the child. Don't compete with it. Don't take it away. But being able to be facilitative, because the family needs all the help it can get. So support the role as of the parent in that place of the child. And secondly, without forming a competing attachment to the parents, try and cultivate a connection with the child so that the child naturally wants to be good for you, naturally wants to measure up to your expectations. Because even very good learners, attachment is tremendous when you do this. Even my own children who were good learners and all gone on towards their highest education, their masters and towards their doctorates and so on. The last ones are still in university, but they've been good learners in this sense, and they were used to getting top marks in the class. But when I, as a parent, would be, very often I get asked, well, what has been your involvement in your children's education? Well, education, I've been very involved, but that's a different question than in their schooling. So I'll limit it to what is your involvement in their schooling? Well, my involvement in the schooling was mainly as a matchmaker. And what I would do is as a very basic matchmaker, What I would do is I would listen for any indication, any sign that my children like their teachers and any compliments I could pass on. Then I would go to the school function and I would saddle up to the teacher and I would say things that, in a sense, make the teacher think that my children like the teacher, right? And then I would listen for anything that I could bring home Dad, how did it go? And Mom, etc. Oh, I talked to your teacher today, and he really loved your answer to this, and I would really work it up. And so that the next day they would come to each other, and both of them would look at each other, and they would smile and nod, and they both think they like each other, you see. And then in the wake of liking each other, the teacher would take much more interest in my student, and my children, who were used to getting top marks anyway, would work. It was incredible. They would work so much harder, because now they were working for the student, and so much more came out of them. And so even though my children, by and large, were emergent, integrative, and adaptives, you could see that attachment even in grade 11 and grade 12 and now in university. And the same thing is true. My boys, my youngest boys, are still in university. But boy, do they work for the profs that they have a relationship with. You can see their relationship. It is still there. So my role was as a matchmaker. Now, from the teacher's role, it is to be able to accept the attachment baton and to create and cultivate that context of attachment. And that factor is more significant than any single other factor. That very simple factor of a student that is in relationship, has a relationship rapport with a teacher, likes his teacher, that will have more influence on his conduct and achievement by any single other factor, including intelligence, curriculum, pedagogy, or technology.
Hallå? Ja. Mitt namn är Kina Wallén. Jag kommer från Rohus, hemundervisning i Sverige. Och jag blev jätteglad över den här titeln. Vad har vi gjort av alla kunskapstörstande barn? För är det någonting som jag känner att mina barn är, så är det kunskapstörstande. Och jag är lite förvirrad över regeringen och alliansen. För de vill alltså förbjuda det här i Sverige nu. Och deras anledning till det är att de, bland annat utbildningsministern, anser att föräldrar kan inte klara av det här. Min äldsta dotter är 12 år och hon har fixat de här. Hon har blivit avcheckad och de kontrollerar henne. Och hon har uppnått de mål som skulle uppnåtts. Anser du att det är en övermäktig sak för en uppgift, en övermäktig uppgift för föräldrar att kunna hemundervisa sina barn i grundskolan?
Well, you have, if you think of two factors here, two factors, you have that in the learning equation, for learning to occur, you have the good learner and the good teacher, right? So you have a good learner plus a good teacher. And which is the most important factor, you see? Which is the most important factor? Well, it turns out that the good learner is a far more important factor than the good teacher. It is far more important. So if you have a good learner, they can learn even when the teacher is quite mediocre, quite flawed, quite, etc., that the good learner is far more important than the good teacher. Well, homes produce good learners. And so this is why it is so astounding that in the homeschooling literature you find that they are the best academically. In 120 studies that were reviewed in United States and Canada, that they have the top marks to enter college. They get the top scores, so that they are actually the maturation process process from the deep attachment is creating wonderful results. And this makes up for the fact that many of the parents have no training whatsoever in how to be a teacher. And so that's how you can explain it, is because a good learner is actually more important in the learning equation than a good teacher. And so it emphasizes why it is that we can have some of the best teachers in the world, some of the highest trained teachers, and yet we have such a problem in the learning equation. The effectiveness of learning is going down. The number of hours generally that a homeschool child has to spend in learning is a fraction of that which they do in the school system, but the effectiveness is much greater. And so that is what I believe is the explanation for those very, very positive results that are all coming in terms of the research.
Okay, I'll take this in English. My name is Jenny Lantz. I'm also in Ruhus. And another common... I'm also in Ruhus, as Kina, the organization for homeschooling in Sweden. Another common argument against homeschooling in Sweden is that the kids don't get to socialize. And we can see in our children that they are very social. But do you see this problem in homeschooling?
No, not at all. First of all, you have to take the root issue. Here is when you think that socializing leads to becoming socialized in terms of rendering fit for society. This is a mistake, of course. This is a big mistake. That there is no relationship between the two. And that's where the mistake is. In the homeschooling research, again, when they do this with measures of empathy and consideration for others, the homeschooling children always win over the school-age children over true measures of socialization, as well as being rendered fit for society, taking their place in society, as far as employment in society. All of these measures, they win. So the answer is, children don't need social interaction. They need deep, fulfilling attachments in order to grow up. Now, the question I often get asked, well, but then how much time does a child need to be with his peers, you know, in terms of so he doesn't turn out to be a misfit, a bit weird, a bit a geek, and he's, you know, awkward and so on. How much time? Well, the amount of time, first of all, happens to be very little. One needs maybe an hour, 2 hours a week, and most kids experience that in some way or another. It's very, very little time to be able to have that kind of, and it's only as much as they can hold on to themselves, and there is not the loss of other attachments. And so, in actual fact, it doesn't require hours upon hours, a little bit of experience, and with cousins it would work. And you have all kinds of experiences with others and so on. And so very little is required to be able to give children practice for consideration and for getting along. And so certainly not the hours and hours. For any of us, if we were in social groupings, as long as we put our children in social groupings, the amount of stress that it would show for adults under, and all this would be tremendous. I myself can't, like right now, I'm about fried. You know, this is more than I can normally handle, you see. Yes. But when I'm in, after I'm with people for a couple of hours in social interaction, I often say to my wife, I've got to go for a walk and collect myself. I'm in danger of losing myself. I can no longer figure out what I think, where I end and where somebody else begins. And I'm 63 years of age, and I can only handle 2 hours. And I expect children to handle hour after hour after hour. Well, of course they can't handle it. Most of us can't handle that. And so the actual time of social interaction has to be the other way. The fact is we have to be very careful that children have not a social interaction in which they lose themselves or lose their attachments to their parents. And so the caution should all be the other way, not how much interaction does a child need, but how much interaction can a child take without losing themselves or without becoming peer attached. So the question actually is, it has to be flipped the other way.
Har du några konkreta råd vad man gör om man upptäcker att barn har tappat den här förmågan? Alltså om man märker att barnen börjar bli mer jämnårig orienterade, vad kan man göra både som lärare och som förälder för att få tillbaka dem så?
Oh, yes. Well, that's a big question. And one third of my book is 2 minutes, okay? 2 minutes. One third of my book is on that question. The good news is, of course, is because it's a relationship, usually we can win them back. And that's a good news. But we have to know that that's what we need to do. And that really we must matter most to our children. We must be their compass points. We must be their source of comfort. We must be their answer in terms of significance. And so a large part of it is just knowledge, so that we interact in that way. And then it has to do if we don't realize that it's the relationship that needs to be tended to, we start focusing on behavior, because as the relationship weakens, often we lose our natural control and influence, and so it starts going bad. And I had that experience with my own oldest two daughters. I thought that peer orientation is something that happened to children on the other side of the tracks. Do you have that phrase in Sweden? No, not the other side of the tracks. On the wrong side of society, okay? It owes to other people, not to us, not to, you know, to the professional middle class, not this. And then my own two children, the oldest ones at that time, they were 15 and 13. Now they're almost 30 and 28. And their peers started to matter more. And once I began to realize what the problem was, then I had to start at the very beginning. Part of it was divide and conquer, is to be able to get them outside of the competition, to spend some time with them alone, one-on-one. That was the best investment I ever made in their lives, to go away with each of them separately. And the whole purpose was to find a way back, to be able to collect them, to be able to get their eyes, the smiles and the nods, to be able to engage the attachment instincts, to be able to nurture the relationship, to be able to provide myself as the answer to their needs for company, for interaction, for significance, for belonging, and to be able to present myself that way. It didn't take that long, actually. It only took 3 or 4 days, especially when they weren't in the company of their peers. You know, this is the thing. I promised my both daughters that they could have time off school, and they said, yippee. And then as soon as I took them to the place of isolation, one on a hiking trip and one on a very isolated beach, they all, the first response was, nobody's here. Of course, I was a nobody, right? And the person that you're not attached to is a nobody. The person you're attached to is everybody. And so I was a nobody, and that was the problem. And my thing I had to remember, the thing I had to remember above anything, is that my whole purpose was I had to be able to win their hearts back. I had to be able to establish a relationship. I had to become this, to find the context where I could be the father they needed. I was very desperate with my second child because she had developed an eating disorder. And she would not let anybody feed her. And she wasn't feeding her properly. And so she was losing weight rapidly. And so I was very desperate because I knew that she had to receive food from me for her to live. And so I needed this. And it was after 4 days, and there was nobody else, that she would, you know, she would say, this is boring. You know, this is boring. Nobody to walk with. I'd love to have a walk with you, you know. I made sure that she couldn't take the canoe out by herself, and I made sure the television was inoperative, and the telephone has somehow etc. So there's nobody but me, you see. And I remembered what my goal was, and finally on the fourth day, she says, "Dad, would it be okay if we cooked together?" This is what I was waiting for. And then she allowed me to cook with her, and soon she would ate my food, and I could just see her pink up, because she was white as a ghost before and she was losing weight. And she needed her father back, but she needed to be in relationship. But I was desperate to be able to get this. And when I finally did get her back, her smiles, I forgot how absolutely delightful her smile was and how it warmed my heart. I had gone cold to her because of, you love your children, but you lose that passion, that liking. And once I got her back, it just all my own love for her and caring for her came back. And she needed a father desperately. But sometimes it's a long trip. In this case, it took me a long time for it to get through my thick head. But once it got through my thick head, the actual journey back was very short. And both of them remember that to this day. You know, when we went home, Tasha, across a ferry and away from the beach in the wilderness and went home, Tasha said to me, she says, Daddy, why did you ever leave me in the first place? And I was quite defensive. And I started saying, I didn't leave you, you left me. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh my goodness, it's a parent's job to hold on to your children. Society isn't making it very easy for us anymore. But it's my job. Of course, I got involved in career. I was renovating a house. I thought that adolescents needed each other rather than me. And I somehow didn't realize I needed to hold on to you. And I promised that to her at that time I would not let go of her, and that I would preserve that relationship. And now she has an 8-year-old grandson whose heart I also need to preserve. But sometimes it takes a lot of work, but it's always worth the investment. The main thing is that our children need us much more than we thought they needed us. They need us, and they even need us as adolescents. That wasn't 2 minutes, but it was much less than the book. You have a lot of questions in
there. Yeah, I have actually. Yeah, it gets my mind going, this. I had a short chat with one of the politicians who left, and it was quite apparent that, so what about the science? We make our decisions anyway. And that's sort of in a nutshell from the discussion with him, and well, now I've said who it was. But so how do we get past this when we're obviously trying to use scientific study, all your experience, and we're trying to influence politicians who are making decisions about our society, and here we're living in a society which is incredibly steered and governed by political system right into our kitchens and bedrooms. And when we have this attitude, is that what's the point? How do we get past this?
Well, that's a very good question, and I'm not a political activist. I am a therapist and so on. But I suspect, and why I write the book, and why I'll be writing more books, and why I do this, is the role of science is good science, to join people with their natural intuition and with their culture of origin, because there was wisdom in it. And it increases confidence. Now, I won't have convinced anybody here, and I understand this. I understand that the people have their own ways of thinking and so on. But there are those here that it feels that when I give you the words, it feels like these are the words that correspond to your inner intuition. And then that gives you confidence because you have a language. And again, the problem is you can be very intuitive, but if you don't have confidence, you don't have confidence to act on your intuition. And if you do not have a language, you can't talk to others about it, and then it will never inform policy. So I see this as a step process. I don't see this as a process going right from here to inform policy. That even though that may be the wishes, I don't really see this as it. I see it as a process. First of all, if we can get the good science out that really joins us to our natural intuition, gives us confidence, gives us fire in our eyes, and a confidence to fight for what we believe, and that we are our children's best bet, I believe that gradually will begin to inform policy, inform attitudes, and we can find our way back. And so that at least is my hope. I would see that the policy changing would probably be the last thing that changes, because it will reflect, as you know, a society. And so my hope is simply an increase in collective consciousness. And if it serves this purpose, then I will feel as if I served a function.
Hello. I have one question that I'm wondering whether there are any examples of schools that have succeeded in, you know, making changes in the direction that you mentioned, you know, that they found ways to both reach the parents as well as the students. Do you have any good examples from real life that you would like to share?
In Canada, I've been around in Canada for a while, and so there are some huge districts. Our schools are organized a bit differently there. Is first of all, our provinces have a lot more to do with education than our federal government does, so we're not centralized there. And then our districts, every school district decides when is elementary school, what is high school, what is et cetera, et cetera. Our provinces have different levels, and so generally in Canada we're chaotic. But it gives a lot of room to do a lot of things. And so a lot of things happen. So yes, there are whole school districts that are using this approach, reaching to the parents and being able to provide this. And they're very excited about it, and there's research that's being done about this. And so, yes, and hopefully there will be more and more models of this. Interesting enough, this has caught on far more in Quebec than it has in English Canada. It's caught on far more in French Canada, and I think they're closer to their intuitions there. I think they can reach back. There's something that is closer for them than in English Canada, because they respond to this material and can apply it much more intuitively. My journey outside of Canada is relatively new, since my book has been interpreted in different languages. And so I don't know of this particular, the way it is. Now, there's all kinds of schools that are informed by attachment, and especially schools that are informed by development. But using this integrated model, I do not know of. But what you speak of is very challenging. Is I really do see the school, and I really do in my image and vision, because we have become a secular society, we have lost the church as a primary purveyor of values and family attitudes. And we have a huge problem now, is that we have nowhere to deliver parent education. We have nowhere to deliver and change this. So here we're lost. The school is the only existing institution left. The churches, when they are involved, are often more involved overseas than here. Not all churches, but generally speaking, we have become secularized as a society. So it seems to me that somehow we have to find our way through, is that also schools become a part of being able to be agents of attachment with families, and being able to join and endear children to their parents, parents to their children, and be an arm of parent education. So this is my hope. I've developed a parent education series for that purpose. It is being started at some schools in the hope that can happen. But we are in a difficult scenario, is that we simply do not have an institution by which we can engage ourselves in being able to support families. And that is difficult. We have to find our way through on that.
You mentioned earlier that even in Japan, the children have the same, are behaving in the same manner as the other Western countries.
Yes.
I'm curious as to one thing. I assume that Japanese families still have housewives, because I understand that in Japan, when you, the reason why so many Japanese women do not marry, because my husband works a lot with Japanese, and he said that they have a lot of single men and single ladies, bachelors, because if you marry in Japan, you have to take care of your husband's parents. So and you have to become a housewife. It's the tradition. I don't understand how come, since they have housewives, how come the children are behaving as they are doing in the rest of the Western world? Or perhaps I misunderstand why they're behaving like that.
I don't actually understand the question. When I was in Japan and addressing this particular issue from an attachment point of view, I was invited to a conference there about the concern for what was happening in the education system, the increase in bullying. This happened very, very quickly in Japan, very quickly, from virtual zero delinquency, zero bullying, and zero truancy to now absolutely atrocious levels of this, and it happened very quickly. But it seems to follow the attachment lines in there, in that Japan also went through a very difficult difficult time when they went from emperor worship, and the whole society was hierarchically arranged in terms of this, to when the company took over for the primary attachment of the male. And so now the average Tokyo male leaves for work, if I can remember my statistics right, by 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning and doesn't return till 10 and 11 o'clock at night, which basically means that Tokyo, an incredible big city, that all the children are growing up fatherless. In this situation, but there are other problems there as well. As the teachers, society carefully orchestrated attachments to the teachers, and all this has broken down as well. So I'm not sure about what you're talking about, but I know that there's been a huge shift in the attachment characteristics of the Japanese culture. Now, the school system in Japanese is not our school system. They don't assume interest and curiosity. They don't assume being able to deal with conflict. It's a very didactic, it's a very attachment-based system. And so when the attachment system falls apart, the school falls apart. And so they are vulnerable in a different way because the attachments are not fostering. Truancy is incredible there. But it seems that there's something that is happening in the attachment infrastructure of the society that is causing it to be undone. And I would say the same thing is happening in Provence. In Provence, the system there in education is the same way. It's much more a relationship-based. The teachers have to shop in the same market in which they teach. All the traditions and rituals are to attach children to the teachers. In the village, there's one festival every 2 weeks. All the teachers attend. There's matchmaking. The parents introduce their children to the teachers. The teachers dance with their prospective students. Everything is, there's all kinds of matchmaking rituals in there. But Paris in its continual system to try to centralize, and because of efficiency, has ruled that there can only be one high school for every three Provençal villages. Now, Provence is a place of villages. And what happens is now when they bus these children to the one high school, in its wake, graffiti increased, bullying increased, everything absolutely escalated because they changed the attachment characteristics of this. Children were no longer attached to their teachers, and so all of a sudden they have all kinds of problems. But they shifted from something that had worked for a long time, hundreds and hundreds of years, and they changed the attachment characteristics, and then it fell apart. Now, in southern France, you wouldn't go there for your children to be, when our children were in the village school. And our children are curious and interested. They love debate. They love the dialectic. They put up their hand and they say, well, I think this and that. The teachers had no tolerance for that. It was not a school, a system that allows for maturation. Curiosity is considered out of order. But they have no behavioral problems there until the attachment things fell apart. So again, it's like a Japanese system. They are not assuming interest and curiosity. They're not assuming the ability for dialectic. It's an attachment-based system, and that becomes very susceptible to falling apart. What I was what I see the answer to in society is not to change our system. I think our system is wonderful in terms of its assumption of a modicum of maturity, but simply not to assume that it's there in every child, and so that we can join it to an attachment-based pedagogy for those who do not show interest and curiosity in the ability to learn from their mistakes. So I am pleading for a hybrid system of bringing the Austrian system and the Provençal system together, yeah, so that we can meet the needs of all students. I think that hybrid would serve us in the, as a future society.
Nej, det är inte på. Jo, jag tar på svenska. Jag har en fråga. För 4 månader sedan så jag är faster. Jag är ju mamma också, men jag är också faster till ett barn som har gått om ett år i skolan. Och där man till och med började informera om att hon kanske skulle börja om ytterligare ett år. Och jag var med som faster på ett rådslag de hade med flera från skolan. Där man hade gjort upp en plan. Och jag bara föreslog att jag skulle hjälpa till med läxor som faster en gång i veckan. Efter det här, det har gått 4 månader nu, så har hon gjort stora framsteg. Hon fick till och med stipendium nu på avslutningen för att hon är den elev som har gjort störst framsteg. Jag undrar, alltså frågan är, alltså som faster, som mormor, typ som farmor, alltså kan vi göra tillräcklig skillnad, alltså kompensera för det råder ju, hon har ju gått igenom en utredning, hon har ingenting som tyder på dyslexi, så att det är ju någonting med liksom relationen, alltså grunden, yes, jordmånen så att säga, för hennes lärande som är någonting fel. Men kan alltså, om, jag har ju väldigt svårt att sluta hjälpa henne nu eftersom jag har ju blivit mer motiverad, jag är ingen pedagog, jag är inte duktig. Så där, jag tycker det här är roligt för min egen del att bli påmind och lära mig på nytt. Men vi har ju fått en relation, hon och jag. Och frågan är, kan den här relationen kompensera tillräckligt mycket för att det ska gå? Hon ska börja nu i 6:an, egentligen i 7:an, men liksom byta skola. Hur kommer det gå? Liksom, vad finns det för... Jag vill ju att hon ska fortsätta lyckas. Kan du svara?
First of all, every child should be so lucky as to have an aunt like you. Oh, yes. This is the answer. This is the answer. The answer is, again, we are putting way too much pressure on parents. Way too much pressure, as if they're the answers to this. No, family is extended family. As grandparents, as aunts, as uncles, we step forward because children are protected by a multitude of caring attachments, and it can be enough. All the research shows is that a child is in one safe, secure, caring attachment, one deep, fulfilling attachment, one. That makes the difference, and it can make all the difference in the world. And so our impact can be huge. But it means that we're not only thinking of our children, we're thinking of our nieces and our nephews. We're thinking of our children and our role in their lives. Not the government's role in their lives, our role in their lives. And so to step up to the plate to be what they need. But this is what every child needs. Every child needs this place, and especially when they become adolescents. You all need, you know, that aunt for a little bit, you know. That place where when the things get a little bit tense, you know, you can move just a little bit, take the pressure off the parents, but it is there. And this is exactly, if we brought the family, the extended family, and utilized the resources of the extended family, supported the extended family, and if we had the attitude in our society that of the important roles that those in the family have, it would make an incredible difference in our children all the way. all the way through school. And your niece is very fortunate to have you. And don't stop. Don't stop. And I'm glad you enjoy it, and it's not just a duty. I'm glad it's a love and a passion for it, because it is absolutely when I worked in the prison system, and that's the end of the line. You see, there is nothing left anymore. And I worked in the prison system, and there was nobody who wanted them. These were foster kids who didn't make it. They're already in prison. And I worked with very violent offenders of all kinds, and worked with them. And I would look through. I would say, well, tell me who you're related to, and so on and so on. Is there anyone here that hasn't given up on you? Is there anyone that you feel still likes you? Is there anyone that is, et cetera, et cetera? Well, I have an aunt or so and so on. Do you mind if I give them a call and tell you how you're doing? And I would plan to do a bit of matchmaking. And what I would do with the matchmaking is I would call Grandma and say, oh, I know he's been a difficult place. I know this kid has been a whole host of trouble, but do you have any love left? Any love left? He needs one person in his life. And all the research shows that if he doesn't have that one person, he's going to be back in jail so fast. That's the only hope, is to have that one person. And the government cannot provide that person. That doesn't mean that some teacher can't step forward. And I've seen teachers who were that person, but they do it on their own. This isn't something that they do it because it's supported by the government. They do it on their own because of their passion, because of their interest. And so it is this place. But if we had this attitude towards children, we could save so many more of them in this. But thank you for that.
I Sverige har vi inte betyg från årskurs 8. Och då har man gått i skolan i nästan 8 år. Då byter plötsligt läraren en roll till bli domare. Många elever och framförallt föräldrar uppfattar oss då som domare som dömer barnen till icke-godkända eller bara till godkända. Och det finns många prestigefyllda gymnasier, alltså nästa nivå där man behöver väldigt höga betyg för att komma in. Och på något sätt så den här rollen förändras. Hur kan jag kombinera som lärare den här anknytningen och kärleken som ska finnas mellan en elev och en lärare samtidigt som de ser man som domaren? För i alla tidiga år har man bara fört fram de positiva egenskaperna och inte tagit fram det som inte fungerar hos eleven. Och inte förrän får ett betyg så ofta blir det en chock. Och både föräldrar och elever ifrågasätter bedömningar och kallar mig domare eller lärarna domare. Och då får man en annan roll och det blir väldigt svårt att upphålla den här kontakten. Hur kombinerar man?
Yes, it is not easy to combine those roles, but a parent has to combine those roles all the time. You have to say the shortcoming of a child, you have to give feedback, you have to say this is not good. But always the message is when you do this, you know, you have to give discipline here and discipline there. Always the challenge is to be able to convey to the child that the relationship is more important than the achievement, that the relationship can survive the shortcoming and so on. And that's the message. And it's an important message to get. So it's one that they have to, that becomes a great challenge is, you know, when a child gets a failing grade, there's still the kind word, I'm so sorry, this isn't what you wanted, is it? But we'll be okay. I'm still your teacher. And so you bridge it. You bridge that place. And that's what we're meant to do, so that they know yes, there are things. We have to be their judge. We have to do this. That is true. But we depersonalize the judgment and we personalize the relationship. And that is always the challenge. We depersonalize the discipline. I have to kick you out of school now. It's not what I wanted to do. This has not been a good day. 3 days and you'll be back. I'll give you a call, you know, in the second day to see how it's going. And you depersonalize the judgment and you personalize the relationship. And you say to the child, I'm holding on to you. I'm holding on to you. I don't just love the winners. I also have love for the losers and so on. And not that you say that word, but you know what I mean. The ones that don't have high grades. But that's always the challenge. It's a challenge in many areas of our life, and I think that's one that we have to try and get that message across to the child in some way.
I have a practical question. I forgot to introduce myself before. I'm Karin Bengtsson. I'm part of the Haro board. I'm thinking of a school that I know, and I would like you to take you there. But unfortunately, you don't live in Sweden, and you will not be able to come. But is there any way, if maybe there's somebody else here as well who would like you to speak to kind of the whole staff at a school? Would it be possible in any way? I know you have DVDs with teaching. Would that be possible to arrange some kind of to let the whole staff listen to one of your lectures?
Yes, that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that is a desire I do have and created video courses because I'm not able to do this anymore. In Canada, I'm not able to go to schools and individual staff. I speak in large conferences now, but because of this, I have done two things. I have provided training programs and courses to study more so that there are those who can intelligently provide this kind of education, as well as provide the actual courses for teachers, courses on teachability, courses on aggression, courses on counterwill, those kinds of courses those can be taught. So, yes, there is that availability in English, though not in Swedish. It's in English. Maybe someday it will be in Swedish as well. But as far as actually coming to speak to a group or so on, Jonas would be the one, Himmelstrand would be the one to come to. I'm hoping that he can figure out how to orchestrate my time here. I'm hoping for an annual trip. I would love to be here for an annual trip, and I'm hoping during that time that I can find a way of being useful, so I can make a contribution to family and to education here in Sweden. And so, however you think that that time can be used, I'm open to ideas of how that can be done.
Not really a question, but more an idea that Haro perhaps can help in some way. I don't know about these courses. Is it, you know, because there's a need for it here? But somehow it needs to be organized. Mm-hmm. I don't know who would do it or how, but it seems like the obvious kind of
this organization forum. Would seem to be important somehow.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly. And it's probably not going to come through the universities here.
Yes.
So
As yet. In Canada, actually, some of the education is now being adopted by the universities so that you can actually take the courses that I designed and get graduate or undergraduate credit. Yeah. And that would be nice.
Yeah, but you're a heretic here, so
yes.
It's hardly likely just now, I suppose.
I can answer for Haro.
Yeah.
Please contact us if there's any way. I was just talking to somebody from Mendes who wants to arrange, you know, like a night for parents and a night for teachers, you know, bring all the schools together in the community. So most definitely contact us. You know, Simmerstrand has been doing this for a while, so
it's good.
So, yes, I would love to be here and feel like I was making a difference, a positive difference for things as you work through in your society.
Okay, thank you. We have in totally 6 children, but we still have 2 children who are fairly young. They are in the 4th grade right now, 11 years old. And at their school, this is not a school, something the school doesn't talk very much about, but they have in reality 3 or 4 boys, 6, 7, 8 years old about, who are no longer teachable. They actually have hired a person basically to keep them out of classroom because so the education can go on for the other students at the school. And that's obvious they don't know what to do with it. They talk with the parents, and the parents say, what kind of school is this where you can't even handle a 6-year-old?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the parents' message to the school, and the school is just stuck. They have no way. I mean, I've seen this myself when I'm there, and the school in reality try to hide it as much as possible, for they are basically ashamed of it. They don't know what to do. So my question to you is, what kind of advice would you have for such a situation and such a school?
Oh, Why such big questions? Oh, yeah, but yes. Well, that's what I actually create courses about. That's exactly. Stuckness is the primary problem of in all society today. And the results of stuckness among young children already is an aggression and huge resistance in a lack of teachability. And the problem is if there is no insight, if there is no understanding, you battle against symptoms. You simply engage in a battle, and this is what is happening. Or you send them off to get clinically diagnosed. And so they come back and say, yes, he has conduct disorder, attention deficit disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, reactive attachment disorder. He is obsessive compulsive and so on. Yes, anything else? Thank you. And so it comes back. And so what do we do with him? I don't know. Send him to a doctor and medicate him and put a medical straight or a chemical straitjacket on him. And so, no, this is dreadful because we have lost insight. We have lost the insight about this. And this is the desire, because when you understand the roots of aggression, when you understand, when the frustration is so immense in these children and all they feel like doing is attacking, all they feel like doing is erupting, when the counter will is so immense because they are in defensive detachment, resisting contact and closeness, and it makes them preoccupied with taboos. And when they are alpha children and can't take direction, and just because you told them to do something, now they have to do the opposite. These are very difficult to manage, but these are all manageable, but you can't manage them at the symptom level. That's where insight is required. And this whole approach in development, it's not about strategy. It's not about, it's about insight, making sense of children from inside out. If you can make sense of a child, then the dance changes. But that's what is required, is to be able to understand. When you see an aggressive child, when you see them instead of disruptive and rude and mean, instead you see this child full of foul frustration, unable to find his tears, defended against his vulnerable feelings, you respond completely different, and that starts leading you out into it. But the answer always is, regardless, I was dealing in my later years in private practice and consulting almost exclusively with children with over 6 diagnoses. And so I was dealing with it, but always the answer was the same. Regardless of the diagnosis, and there's no pill to make children grow up, the answer was always the same. The answer was the more that is not working, the more problems there are, the more the answer is in relationship to those adults who care about him. And so if you can foster that relationship and you can soften the emotion so that the child can feel again and move from mad to sad, when you can do this, remarkable results can happen. But the two things that are most significant in all children are right relationships with those responsible for them and soft hearts. And so this is the answer to compensate for any diagnosis and so on. And so it becomes very simple. And who is best positioned to do this? Who is best positioned to do this, if they understand, are the adults who care about the child, the parents or the teachers. And so I would always work not directly with children, but directly with I would always say, give me an adult who cares about this child. A grandmother, an aunt, give me, a teacher, preferably a mom and dad, if there's one there, give me that adult, and I will try to help them see their child from the inside out, and therefore be able to make a difference. And now, my only way of doing this now is through designing courses for this. So that's what I try to help to do, to design courses, and so courses for teachers to be able to make sense of these very difficult children, and their numbers are escalating. They are increasing. And so with these very difficult children, to be able to find a way through. The good news is that when you are able to see this, the results are remarkable. These children, can be brought back into the system. Well, I hope that these words have resonated with your inner intuition. That's my greatest desire. It's not so much to convince anybody differently from what they see, but hopefully it can give you words for what you felt deeply inside of you, resonated with your inner intuition, given you a language that can increase your confidence that families are the context in which children are meant to be raised, teachers can benefit, or teachers can teach best the children that come that are the fruit of deep fulfilling attachments from home, and that when teachers don't have the benefit of this, then they are best to go into to develop relationships with these students, because that becomes the answer to compensate for it. And that that our best hope in our society is to be able to see that parents are best positioned to be the persons in society to raise children, and that we need to support them, find our confidence to do this in our society. Thank you very much for inviting me again, and all the best to you and your challenges here in Sweden. Thank you.